The Speaker, I beg to report that the Standing Finance Committee of the House considered the estimates of expenditure for the financial year 2005-2006 and beg to move that the Honourable House of Assembly do adopt the report of the Standing Finance Committee on the estimates of expenditure in the sum of $1,121,460,015 for the financial year 2006-2007, and that the said sum to form a charge against the Consolidated Fund and other funds of the State of St. Lucia.
Honourable Members, the question is that the House of Assembly do adopt the report of the Standing Finance Committee on the estimates of expenditure in the sum of $1,121,460,015 for the financial year 2006-2007, and that the said sum to form a charge against the Consolidated Fund and other funds of the State of St. Lucia. I now put the question, as many are of that opinion, say aye.
Aye.
As many are of a contrary opinion, say no. I think the ayes are. The ayes are. Motions on the Prime Minister and Minister for Finance.
Mr. Speaker, I'd like to move the following motion signing my name. Be it resolved that the House of Assembly to approve the estimates of expenditure for the year 2006-2007 amounting to $1,121,460,015 as a charge against the Consolidated Fund and other funds of the State of St. Lucia. Mr. Speaker, the budget speech that is to be delivered shortly deals precisely with that motion, and so I need not say any more on this motion, as the budget address will explain in full detail the motion that is before us for approval. So, Mr. Speaker, without further ado, I urge that we move to the substance of the business this afternoon.
Bills?
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move for first reading a bill shortly entitled Appropriation 2006-2007.
Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move that Standing Order number 48, sub order 2, be suspended to allow this bill to be taken through its remaining stages at the sitting.
Honourable Members, the question is that Standing Order 48, sub rule 2, be suspended to enable this bill to go through its remaining stages at the sitting of the Honourable House. I now put the question. As many are of that opinion, say aye. As many are of the contrary opinion, say no. I think the ayes are. The ayes are. Leave is granted, Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I beg to move for second reading a bill shortly entitled Appropriation 2006-2007.
Minister, Deputy Prime Minister.
Speaker, I beg to move for the suspension of Standing Order 32-9 to enable the Honourable Minister of Finance to introduce the appropriation bill for second reading without interruption.
Honourable Members, the question is that Standing Order 32, sub order 9, be suspended to enable the Honourable Prime Minister to introduce the appropriation bill for second reading uninterrupted. I now put the question, as many are of that opinion, say aye.
Aye.
As many are of the contrary opinion, say no. I think the ayes are it. The ayes are it. Leave it to the Honourable.
Speaker, following the severe recession in 2001,
Delusia's economy has grown from strength to strength. In 2002, real GDP grew a bit marginally by 0.5% as the economy emerged out of the deep recession. Since then, Mr. Speaker, the growth rate has picked up strongly, moving from 3.1% in 2003 to 4% in 2004, and now to 5.4% in 2005. This momentum is expected to continue, and barring any natural disasters, a growth of 6.6% is projected in 2006. This is not an accident, Mr. Speaker. It is the outcome of the sound economic policies that this government has pursued. I am of the view, Mr. Speaker, that this phase of economic expansion will continue through 2006 into 2008. This growth will be sustained by significant activity in the tourism, construction, and banking financial sectors. It is clear from the report on economic developments in the country for 2005 that the deliberate counter-cyclical fiscal measures and incentive programs implemented over the last 5 years have been successful. The economy is therefore poised to benefit over the medium term from the policy yield of the last few years. Growth, however, is likely to decelerate to more sustainable levels as investment stabilizes and consumption increases. The expansion in the economy, Mr. Speaker, was driven by the tourism industry, the construction sector, and manufacturing. Developments in the tourism industry have had a catalytic impact on the performance of other sectors of the economy. This is evident by the large-scale projects currently in progress and the new plans which commenced operations during the 2005 calendar year. There have been positive spillover effects into construction activity, tourism, transportation, the distributive trades, banking and insurance services, which no doubt has increased the number of jobs available for St. Lucians. Mr. Speaker, the growth in visitor arrivals continued despite the emergence of several threats to the sector. These factors included increases in oil prices, continued challenges in major source markets, and the impact of an active hurricane season. The tourism sector, as measured by the value-added contributions of hotel and restaurants, expanded by 6.3% and accounted for 13.6% of real GDP, retaining its position as the principal engine of economic growth in St. Lucia. Visitor arrivals for January to December 2005 registered significant increases for stayover and yachting visitors of 6.5% and 21.9% respectively. The growth in stayover arrivals is attributable to the Jazz Festival and a strong wedding and honeymoon niche market, increased airlift capacity from the United States and Europe, the hosting of international cricket matches, and the marketing efforts of the St. Lucia Tourist Board. However, U.S. home porting and constraints in the domestic berthing capacity limited the overall performance of the cruise sector, which registered a decrease of 18% below figures for 2004. This sector, however, is poised for significant recovery in 2006-2007. The hotel occupancy rate increased by 6.8%. This mirrored the performance of stayover arrivals. The all-inclusive category recorded moderate growth in occupancy levels, while convention hotels and small properties showed considerable improvements of 14.2% and 5.8% respectively. Construction activity in 2005 posted a 10.4% growth,
While its share of real GDP increased from 6.7% in 2004 to 8% in 2005. This growth was led largely by private sector construction activity, particularly in the tourism and housing sectors. Public sector construction expenditure more than doubled to $134.5 million after recording a decline of 9.2% in 2004. The value of manufacturing output for 2005 increased by 10.2% to $156.7 million compared to a growth of 3% in 2004. The continued strong performance of the food and beverage, paper and paperboard, and electrical components of sectors accounted for 80% of the production of the manufacturing sector. That sector's contribution to real GDP was measured at 5.6%. The strides made by the manufacturing sector in 2005 are an important milestone as this sector prepares to face the challenges of operating in a more liberalized and competitive environment. Notwithstanding an increase in livestock production, Mr. Speaker, indications are that the agricultural sector struggled in 2005 while experiencing reductions in output of bananas, non-traditional crops, and fish landings. The real output of the sector fell by 22% in 2005 following marginal growth of 1.8% in the previous year. Banana production fell by 36.2% as a result of the combined impact of Hurricane Ivan in September 2004, which destroyed an estimated 1,400 acres and leaf spot disease. Further, there were also significant declines in the value-added contribution of non-traditional crops of 16.9% and fisheries by 6.8%. In contrast, the livestock subsector expanded for the second consecutive year with a growth of 2.1%. Developments in the financial sector during 2005 were reflective of activity in the real economy. The banking and insurance sector expanded by 8.7%, following a growth of 4.9% in the previous year. The banking subsector, which grew by 9.9%, contributed significantly to that strong performance. In 2005, Mr. Speaker, consistent with the expansion taking place within the economy, domestic credit increased by 21.3% to $1.8 billion, largely on account of increased demand for loans by the private sector. Households and business credit grew by 13.3% to $951.01 million and 19.2% to $966.3 million respectively. The net credit to central government fell by 33.7% to $84.9 million as a result of strong growth in deposits of 14.6%. Deposit liabilities grew by 13.3% to $2.5 billion in 2005. And I want to repeat that, Mr. Speaker, to grasp this sheer scale of this economy at this time. Deposit liabilities grew by 13.3% to $2.5 billion in 2005. Of this amount, 41% were savings deposits, which grew by 12.8% to $1.04 billion, following moderate growth of 6.9% in 2004. Time deposits grew by 5.8% to $797.5 million, following a marginal growth of 0.4% in 2004. By contrast, demand deposits grew by 20.3% to $621.3 million, building on growth of 38.7% in 2004. During 2005, there was a slight tightening of liquidity as measured by the loans and advances to deposits ratio. The ratio rose from 80.7 to 85.7 as the growth in loans and advances of 20.3% outstripped the 13.3% expansion in deposits. Rising international petroleum prices increased inflationary pressures during 2005. The inflation rate, as measured by the percentage change in the 12-month average of the consumer price index, the CPI, increased to 3.9% compared to a rate of 1.5% in 2004. On the domestic front, movements in the consumer price index were influenced largely by the food, fuel, light, and transport communication sub-indices, reflecting the pass-through effects of rising global oil prices. Mr. Speaker, in 2005, the value of imports increased by 11.1% to $1.2 billion, compared with growth of 4.1% in 2004. Exports, on the other hand, declined by 31.9% to $170.6 million on account of the decline in banana production. Consequently, this led to a widening of the trade deficit by 29.3% to $906.2 million. In contrast to the performance in the merchandise trade account, the surplus in the services account grew by 9.6% to $640.3 million following a growth of 24.9% in 2005. This performance was supported by a 9.3% increase in inflows associated with activity in the tourism industry. The surplus on the capital and financial account rose by 28.2% to $448.9 million, representing 20.4% of GDP. On the capital account, Mr. Speaker, capital grants declined from a low base of $6 million to $4.2 million, reflecting the delayed implementation of new and revised procedures by the European Commission for accessing and spending grant funds. The surplus on the capital and financial account was insufficient to offset the current account deficit, and as a result, an overall balance of payment deficit of $46.9 million was recorded. This, Mr. Speaker, was financed by drawing down on St. Lucia's share of the imputed reserves in the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank. Mr. Speaker, I am delighted to report that central government's fiscal operations improved significantly in 2005-2006, reflecting strengthened revenue performance as a result of continued economic expansion and moderate growth in expenditure. The current surplus increased to $83 million, or 3.5% of GDP, mainly due to improved revenue performance of 7.7%. and moderate growth in expenditure of only 3.7%. Tax revenue collections exceeded the approved estimates by $72 million, or 13%, and amounted to $554.6 million. This year's collections were also 10.1% higher than last year. The Customs and Excise Department collected $326.4 million, approximately $21.8 million, or 7% more than the approved estimates. Revenue from the Inland Revenue Department amounted to $237.5 million and was $49.8 million, or 26.5% above the approved estimates. Mr. Speaker, I know that the usual skeptics will question the growth rate of 5.4% for last year. However, as they say, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Revenue can only grow as fast as the economy is expanding, so one provides proof of the other. Current expenditure increased by 6.2% to $512.7 million over 2004-2005. Reflecting higher wages and salaries, pension contributions, rental payments, utilities, and communication. Capital expenditure, on the other hand, continued to be affected by implementation delays and consequently declined by 3.8% to $158 million. Current revenue increased by 7% to $595.6 million in the fiscal year 2005-2006,
and was significantly influenced by a 17.4% increase in revenue from international trade.
Speaker, total outstanding public debt, which stood at $1.53 billion, declined slightly as a percentage of GDP from 64.9% in 2004 to 64.1% by the close of 2005. However, central government debt increased by 9.7% to $1.30 billion, or 55% of GDP. It is important to note that as a result, St. Lucia remains within the prudential limit of the 60% central government debt to GDP ratio prescribed by international institutions, and Mr. Speaker, is the only independent CARICOM member state, with the exception of Trinidad and Tobago. In keeping with government's debt management policy of refinancing high-cost loans with cheaper financial instruments, interest payments fell by 7.7% to $72 million in 2005-2006, compared with an increase of 19.7% in the previous year. In 2005, the average cost of debt declined, leading to a corresponding drop in the weighted average of debt to 5.93% from 5.96% in 2004. Mr. Speaker, the progressive improvement of real output growth over the period 2001 to 2005 was also reflected positively, or has also reflected positively, on the labor market. Trend analysis of the data derived from the labor force survey indicates that the unemployment rate has declined considerably during the economic expansion phase 2003 to 2005. According to the Department of Statistics, the unemployment rate dropped by 3.6 percentage points from an average of 22.3% in 2003 to 18.7% in early 2005. It is also important to note that as economic activity intensified during 2005, there was a corresponding fall in unemployment within the country. Thus, an unemployment rate of 15.7% was recorded over the period October to December 2005, a full 4 percentage points lower than the rate recorded during the same period in 2003. And I expect, Mr. Speaker, that when the figures are in for the first quarter of this year, the unemployment rate will fall below 15.7%. This is one of the three lowest unemployment rates recorded since 1992, when the Department of Statistics commenced the compilation of data on unemployment. And it is instructive to note that even in the heyday of the banana industry, the lowest unemployment rate that St. Lucia recorded was 15%. According to Mr. Edward St. Catherine, the Director of Statistics, and I quote him, "The main driver for the decline in the unemployment rate is growth in the number of employment opportunities available in the hotels and restaurants and the construction sector. With employment in hotels and restaurants skewed towards the employment of women by a factor of 2 women to every 1 man employed and a factor of 6 men to every 1 woman employed in the construction sector. The hotels and restaurant sectors added approximately 3,500 persons, while the construction sector added approximately 2,500 persons. While this is a healthy development, it must be sustained since the situation can be reversed due to the cyclical nature of construction activity and the fickle nature of the tourism sector. For the first time, quarterly employment statistics for the second and third quarter of 2005 are indicating that the number of persons employed in the hotel and restaurant sectors has surpassed the agriculture sector, recording in the third quarter a total of 8,980 persons employed, when compared to 7,460. The construction sector employed approximately as many persons as did the agriculture sector in the third quarter of 2005, unquote. Given the forecast for a greater level of economic activity in 2006, I predict that the unemployment rate will be even lower towards the end of 2006. St. Lucia is therefore positioned to experience its lowest rate of unemployment over the last 15 years. Having reviewed the performance of our economy and the challenges ahead, it would be interesting to compare our performance with that of our regional neighbors. Mr. Speaker, growth in CARICOM countries was generally weaker than anticipated in 2005, as persistently high international oil prices eroded the already weakened fiscal and external positions of member states. Expansion in real economic output was driven by construction activity and to a lesser extent by tourism. Most countries, however, experienced a marginal downturn in the tourism industry during 2005. That experience was unlike the experience in St. Lucia. This may have been due to increases in transportation costs, especially from long-haul destinations. Inflation was moderately higher in 2005 than in the previous year. This was fueled mainly by rising energy prices and higher food prices. Many governments in the region were forced to increase the prices of fuel and liquefied petroleum gas. During 2005, the Trinidad and Tobago economy posted its 12th consecutive year of growth. Driven by a buoyant energy sector, the economy registered real GDP growth of 6.5%. However, the economy faced the challenge of combating rising inflation. Escalating food prices ushered a pushed inflation to a high of 7.2%. Real GDP growth for Jamaica slowed to 1.5% in 2005. Adverse weather conditions caused a 24.4% decline in output in agriculture, forestry, and fishing in the first half of the year. This outcome, combined with high international oil prices, resulted in a 15% increase in annual inflation. Driven by significant public and private sector investment in preparation for Cricket World Cup 2007, the Barbados economy recorded real output growth of 4.1% in 2005. However, output in the traditional foreign exchange earners, sugar and tourism, remained sluggish. Against the backdrop of strong import growth and a decline in export receipts, the Central Bank of Barbados raised the minimum deposit rate in an attempt to dampen spending. The rate of inflation rose to 5%, reflecting the effects of high energy prices. A 2.5% contraction in real economic growth in Guyana was explained mainly by the decline in value added from the agriculture, fishing, and bauxite sectors. Given the marginal exchange rate appreciation against the US dollar in 2005, inflation in Guyana increased by 5.5%. Among the economies of the Eastern Caribbean Currency Union, there was a general increase in economic activity in 2005. The economies of the Eastern Caribbean Currency Union registered an average inflation rate of 3.5% in 2005, while real output for the economies expanded on average by 4%. Output in Angola was estimated at about 9% compared to the 14% upturn in the previous year, owing mainly to robust tourism activity. Grenada continued to recover from the devastating impact of Hurricane Ivan, with real GDP growth estimated at about 2%. But that country faces a huge financing gap for development projects. Antigua and Barbuda recorded economic growth of over 3% on the strength of construction activity, while output in the tourism sector stagnated. In Dominica, economic activity is said to have expanded robustly, with real GDP growing at about 3.5%. Expansion was fueled by strong domestic demand, consumer imports, and credit. Growth was achieved despite declines in tourism arrivals, banana and non-banana agricultural exports. Same story, Mr. Speaker, around the region. This review, Mr. Speaker, would be incomplete without reference to developments in the international economy. During 2005, economic activity in the global economy was challenged by exogenous shocks such as rising international oil prices, a very active hurricane season in the United States, and macroeconomic imbalances of some major economies. Global oil prices increased sharply by 27.2% over the period January to December 2005, driven primarily by growing demand, supply constraints, and geopolitical uncertainty related to tensions between the U.S. and Iran. On the demand side, Mr. Speaker, the economies of China and India continue to expand significantly, thus placing an upward pressure on prices. The supply of petroleum was constrained by refinery capacity as Hurricanes Katrina and Iris forced the closure of refineries in the Gulf of Mexico. Social and political instability in some oil-producing regions, as well as concerns about low refinery capacity in the petroleum market, also increased speculation on the oil market, thereby increasing prices. Consequently, growth in global output continued at a brisk pace of 4.3% in 2005, relative to a strong outturn of 5.1% in 2004. Despite slower growth in real output of 3.5%, the United States economy remained the main engine of global economic growth. The modest expansion of the U.S. economy in 2005 occurred against the backdrop of an intense 2005 hurricane season, record energy costs, high consumer spending, and supportive financial market conditions. The inflation rate in the United States rose to 3.4% in 2005, following a rate of 3% in 2004. In response to inflationary pressure, the Federal Reserve Bank increased the federal funds rate from 2.25% to 4.25% in 2005. The Canadian economy grew by 3% in 2005, despite a marked appreciation of the Canadian dollar, which was driven by high commodity export prices and relatively flexible monetary policies. In 2005, China and India, and a few other large developing economies, exerted tremendous influence on the growth outturn for the global economy. China maintained, and I'm speaking of the People's Republic of China, maintained its substantial growth momentum, despite administrative and monetary measures to curb overheating in selected sectors. Buoyed by strong investment in manufacturing exports, real GDP expanded by 9.3%. Similarly, Mr. Speaker, economic activity in India grew by about 7% in 2005 on the strength of increased agricultural output, growth in the textile and service sectors, and strong industrial output. Economic output in Japan slowed to 2.2% in 2005, supported by healthier bank and corporate balance sheets and higher consumer and business confidence. Mr. Speaker, conditions in the Eurozone remained weak in 2005 as real output was estimated at 1.4% compared to an increase of 2% in the previous year. This outcome was the result of slow growth in most of the 12 countries of the region. However, it must be noted that weak domestic demand in Germany and Italy in particular impacted on the growth performance of that region. Despite rising oil prices, the Eurozone registered relative low inflation of 2.2% consistent with weak domestic demand. In the United Kingdom, Mr. Speaker, economic activity in 2005 slowed to 1.7%, largely due to weaker consumption as the housing boom threatened. Inflation grew to 2.2%, reflecting the continued increase in crude oil prices and transportation costs. Mr. Speaker, this completes the economic report card. I am sure that honorable members will now be interested in knowing the reasons for St. Lucia's remarkable turnaround. Our government, Mr. Speaker, has created an economic environment that has engendered confidence and attracted significant investment. We took the bold decision to encourage investment in tourism and provided special concessions for hotel and guest house developments, particularly for Cricket World Cup. This policy has proven to be a major success. The challenge we now face in the tourism industry is actually one that I'm sure many governments would love to have, and that is to manage the growth from these investments. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, even more investments are forecast this year. I shall, however, await the pronouncements by the investors. We have made considerable investments in infrastructure because we have a major problem of aging and deteriorating physical assets. We have had to undertake significant investments in our roads, schools, police and fire stations and health centers. Our government has also made judicious and timely fiscal policy decisions that catalyze the growth of the economy. While we have pursued counter-cyclical fiscal policies to stimulate economic recovery at some cost, these have been done within a medium-term framework of ensuring that our debt position remains sustainable. Speak up. Our economy is now in an expansion phase. Investment, particularly in the tourism sector, is at a record level. Business confidence is very strong and employment is increasing. The greater our economic success, the greater is our challenge to sustain it and keep the forward momentum. But, Mr. Speaker, I must caution that our recent economic success, has brought its own set of challenges. The economic challenges we face now are different from those of 3 years ago. 3 years ago, we were concerned with the slow rate of economic growth. Today, we face the prospect of an economy that may be expanding too rapidly. The signs are evident. Demand is outstripping supply. We are beginning to see labor shortages in the construction industry and shortages of construction material. It is vital for us to guard against the overheating of the economy, as this could result in higher inflation, which can erode some of the gains that we have achieved. We are all aware that labor shortages lead to higher wages. Shortages of goods lead to higher inflation, which in turn lead to higher wage demand, resulting in a vicious cycle that would seriously affect St. Lucia's long-term competitiveness and growth. This is a matter that must be monitored very closely. As the pace of private sector investment increases, government will have to adjust the implementation of new programs. The focus this year, Mr. Speaker, is to continue implementing projects that have already commenced. Few major projects will be announced. We will continue to press on with our policy of restructuring and transforming the economy in order to create new jobs that will replace old ones in industries that are either stagnant or stalled. This means, Mr. Speaker, that we must press ahead with developing the financial services sector and strengthening investment in the information technology sector. This sector has the potential to absorb the hundreds who graduate from our secondary schools. Health IT, for example, appears to have weathered the storms of recession and now employs 230 persons. By the end of May, the number will increase to 300. On June 1st, 2006, e-services group, St. Lucia Limited, intends to commence operations in St. Lucia. The operations will be introduced in four phases. At the end of phase four, which is scheduled for December 2006, the company hopes to employ 480 persons. Already the company has placed advertisements in the local newspapers for its first 120 employees. This sector, Mr. Speaker, has potential that must be explored further. Our ultimate goal, Mr. Speaker, is to provide all St. Lucians with the opportunity to enjoy a better standard of living. This can only be achieved by increasing productivity and in particular by targeting economic sectors that offer the potential to increase productivity. While we strive to achieve balanced growth so as to minimize our vulnerability, it is also true that the service sectors offer the greatest potential to increase productivity and hence the standard of living of our people. Our strategy is to diversify with a strong focus on developing the services sector, ensuring in the process stronger and more direct linkages with the agricultural sector. the strategy in the path of relying on preferential treatment for bananas and insulating our industries from competition can no longer work in today's world. Sadly, Mr. Speaker, sadly, some politicians who are patently out of touch with present-day realities are recommending an impossible return to these policies. With the advent of the CARICOM single market, there will be both threats and opportunities. We must, therefore, focus on exploiting the opportunities and minimizing the threats. I know that some of our manufacturers will be weary of the competition, viewing it as a threat to their survival. We understand their fears and will encourage our manufacturers to retool and modernize their operations to allow them to compete and take advantage of the larger market. Our government will, therefore, through its private sector development program, continue to provide assistance to the private sector to enhance competitiveness. Mr. Speaker, lest we be judged adversely from our own pronouncements, I wish to bring to the attention of honorable members a recent assessment of our economy by the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. For the sake of clarity, let me quote what the executive directors had to say in their report, which was issued on February 9, 2006. Quote, directors welcome the strong growth performance of St. Lucia's economy, with a recovery in tourist arrivals and strong investment in tourism infrastructure, more than offsetting the continued decline in banana exports. Directors commended the authorities for their record of prudent public debt management. The best within the Eastern Caribbean currency union, and for the progress made in fiscal consolidation over the past 2 years. And I want to repeat for the benefit of the then member from Denry North. Directors welcome the recent strong growth performance of St. Lucia's economy, with a recovery in tourist arrivals and strong investment in tourism infrastructure, more than offsetting the continued decline in banana exports. Directors commended the authorities for their record of prudent public debt management, the best within the ECCU, Eastern Caribbean Currency Union, and for the progress made in fiscal consolidation over the past years. Let me get aside now, Mr. Speaker. While these comments undoubtedly represent an excellent report card, we should not be complacent as the economy continues to face difficult challenges, particularly from external forces over which we have little or no control. The report from the IMF gives us an opportunity to assess and benchmark our performance and to evaluate the challenges that we need to confront. In the fiscal sector, there is need for us to continue to pay attention to fiscal consolidation. This would require ensuring stability in our revenue base and improving the efficiency of expenditure, with particular emphasis on the public sector investment program. As you are aware, Mr. Speaker, fuel prices have been the focus of our attention over the last year. Undoubtedly, you have been following the erratic movements in the international price of oil. And I am sure that you, along with the citizens of St. Lucia, have been concerned about the impact that oil prices have had on the price of items that we import for consumption. There should be no doubt in our minds now that oil prices have a significant impact on the cost of living in St. Lucia. More importantly, we continue to be concerned about the effects that the escalating prices have on eroding our revenue base. A significant percentage of our consumption tax on imports comes from oil imports. Whenever international oil prices increase, and we do not make the commensurate adjustments, government loses revenue. This, of course, has the effect of limiting our ability to fund our operations. The IMF has identified this as a threat to our fiscal position. Mr. Speaker, the present situation is precarious and untenable. Over the period 2002-2005, oil prices have increased by more than US$30 per barrel, reaching as high as US$70 per barrel. While oil prices averaged in the range of US$60 to $66 per barrel over the first 3 months in 2006, prices have increased considerably in the month of April, reaching a peak of US$75 per barrel on April 21st. Given the continued geopolitical uncertainties in the Gulf, especially Iran's nuclear standoff with the international community and disruptions in the supply in Nigeria, the prognosis is that oil prices will remain in the range of US$65 to US$70 per barrel. Government has, to the extent possible, Mr. Speaker, adopted an energy pricing policy which aims at keeping retail prices fixed in the face of rising oil prices. This policy has been undertaken at great cost, resulting in the erosion of consumption tax revenue from petroleum. Mr. Speaker, as I speak, the consumption tax rate is negative, which in effect means that government is subsidizing the cost of fuel. The current subsidy is around 19 cents per gallon. And to translate, Mr. Speaker, each gallon of gas that a motorist buys at the pump, the government is now subsidizing that gallon of gas by 19 cents. While the government will do all in its power to minimize the inflationary impact on the consumer, the current policy is simply unsustainable. It is not only unleaded fuel that is subsidized from time to time. The government has continued its policy of subsidizing the cost of LPG or cooking gas, as it is more commonly known, in an attempt to reduce the cost of living to consumers. The current subsidy on LPG or cooking gas is 59 cents per pound. When you go and buy a cylinder of cooking gas, the government is subsidizing that price by 59 cents per pound, which in effect amounts to a subsidy of $14.75 per 25-pound cylinder. I really want the speaker that to sink in. I really would like that to sink in, because it's important that our citizens know the extent to which this government subsidizes this commodity. In other words, Mr. Speaker, every single time someone buys a small cylinder of cooking gas, government is paying $14.75 to ensure that the price of that cylinder remains at a level that St. Lucians can afford. We will continue to monitor the situation. If prices remain high and do not recede, then the government will have no choice but to join other CARICOM states and announce increases later this year. The constant movement in oil prices points to the need to look into alternative ways by which revenue can be collected on a more transparent and consistent basis. So during the course of the year, government will be undertaking an assessment of a mechanism that will accomplish this objective. We are aware that other CARICOM states have implemented procedures to stabilize their revenue intake. So we will be pursuing this initiative along with a proposal that was tabled at a recent Eastern Caribbean Central Bank Monetary Council meeting in February this year. This review will also include an assessment of the request by petroleum dealers for an increase in dealer margins. They have been knocking on the door for some time. Another challenge for which we see an opportunity is to improve our expenditure management policy. While we have been able to contain our expenditure within tolerable limits, resulting in a current account surplus, we must be vigilant in containing costs, improving the efficiency of expenditure, and in particular, improving the quality of the services delivered by government. We must ensure that taxpayers get value for money. Our objective is to formulate a sustainable medium-term framework which will be underpinned by a comprehensive three-year capital investment program. In the area of current expenditure, we must aim to improve public service delivery and reduce wastage. By curbing wastage, more resources become available for other important government services. We will continue our objective of streamlining the way the public service does its business. For the avoidance of doubt, Mr. Speaker, I must restate and re-emphasize that government is not contemplating the layoff of public servants. As a matter of fact, the size of the public service, Mr. Speaker, continues to increase and will increase with the new schools under construction. However, we must agree that we can do things better, more cost-effectively and with greater efficiency. This is the challenge and the opportunity that can make a difference in improving our expenditure management. So during the financial year, I will be imploring our public sector reform unit, permanent secretaries and heads of departments to pursue initiatives that will enhance service delivery to citizens and improve productivity. Mr. Speaker, during the course of our budget discussions with agencies, many expenditure initiatives were submitted on the basis of a priority need for Cricket World Cup 2007. Everything was put on the back of Cricket World Cup 2007. It was interesting to see the number of proposals that were submitted. Unfortunately, many of these proposals could not be entertained because of their costs. But I want to challenge public sector managers that in the same way that a proposal can be submitted to incur additional costs, they should also submit proposals that can improve efficiency and reduce costs. Surely the creativity that was used in submitting these new initiatives can be used to fashion ways of keeping expenditures down. Another challenge aligned with expenditure management is the need for improving prioritization and monitoring of the capital budget. We have observed that government agencies with the best of intentions program expenditure for which there are inordinate delays in implementation. We know, Mr. Speaker, that delays in the receipt of donor funding has been a major problem. However, another major reason for the tardiness is the capacity of agencies to manage their capital programs. A common problem is that projects are poorly prepared and an unstructured approach is often taken with respect to monitoring. Hence, there is a need to approach project preparation and planning more scientifically and include only well-conceptualized projects on our work agenda. Yes, the government will want to ensure that its priority projects are pursued, but herein lies the challenge and opportunity. Get it right, and we would have achieved the objective of timely completion at the least cost possible. This challenge is not insurmountable, as there is evidence in recent times of projects that have been started and completed on time and with cost savings. We therefore need to learn lessons from the successful projects that have been implemented. Mr. Speaker, the most critical constraint that we face in transforming our economy is the limited skills of our labor force. Human resource development is at the heart of the success of economies that have recorded sustained growth and development. Recognizing this, our government has embarked on the implementation of universal secondary education, the establishment of the Dufour Technical Institute, and the continuation and expansion of skills training by the National Skills Development Center. These programs will go a long way in providing the new skills required for the new economy. Government will continue to implement measures that will support and catalyze the growth and transformation of the economy. In particular, government will aim to eliminate bureaucratic hurdles and bottlenecks that impede the growth of business. I understand that the implementation of the Ascuda Plus Plus pilot project in Beaufort has significantly improved the efficiency of the customs department, resulting in reduced processing time for clearing goods. While government will focus on simplifying the bureaucracy, there is also a need to ensure that parallel measures are taken to safeguard our revenue. Speaker, government will continue to make the necessary adjustments and the necessary investments in infrastructure that are required for a growing economy. Investments in roads and water are critically needed to support the growing economy. I will expand on the specific programs later on in my presentation. Finally, St. Lucia will need to review its tax policy and tax structure in the light of the changing structure of its economy and the regional economy. I shall again elaborate on this matter a little later on. Speaker, everyone knows by now that we will be host to the 2007 Cricket World Cup. Indeed, the government of St. Lucia has borrowed funds to facilitate the development of facilities and for other necessary preparations, including some very important legacy components. It is perhaps opportune, Mr. Speaker, that I remind St. Lucians that it is the government of St. Lucia and not the ICC or any other entity that is funding all of our preparations for the Cricket World Cup. Therefore, every playing facility that is upgraded, be it the Minda Phillip Park or the Groseley Playing Field, all of the flooded lights that are installed at the Bosaju Cricket Ground, every yard of public road that is rehabilitated along the Bosaju Bellarosa Road, all of the improvements in our emergency medical services and our security services, every volunteer who is trained, and every one of our communities that is branded is paid for by the government of St. Lucia. Our guiding principle has been that we want to host the best Cricket World Cup ever, and that the event should bring economic benefit for as wide a cross-section of our population as possible. Moreover, while we strive to do so, we must recognize that we are a developing country and that the hosting of Cricket World Cup is just one of the many challenges that we must face. But, Mr. Speaker, the Cricket World Cup event will come and go. And after all the euphoria of hosting the exciting matches and the thousands of visitors, we would all be holding our collective breath and wondering, what next? Will we be able to cope with the expansion that was created in our economy? Will there be, as some predict, a hard fall for the economy? Is our economy doomed for a period in the doldrums in the post-Cricket World Cup period? We do not pretend to be clairvoyant, Mr. Speaker, but these are questions that we considered very carefully when we made the decision to bid to be a host venue in the 2007 ICC Cricket World Cup. Our predictions are that our economy will grow by no less than 6.6% and 5.4% in 2006 and 2007 respectively. Our projections show a reduced GDP growth in 2008 and resurgence in 2009. Our analysis shows that the inevitable slowdown in investment associated with the completion of major projects will be offset by an increase in consumption related to the increased employment generated by the new hotels. Of course, Mr. Speaker, our predictions need to be tempered with the uncertainties that inevitably arise when one is making economic projections so far down the road. More specifically, I wish to point out a certain event over which we have no control, like a world recession or an oil price shock, could derail our projections. And of course, Mr. Speaker, we cannot forget the possibility of adverse weather or hurricanes. However, what these predictions assist us in doing is to take a more clinical look at the areas of economic activity to which we should pay attention. And here lies our ability to influence whether the aftermath of the 2000 Cricket World Cup will be a hard or soft landing. Mr. Speaker, there are some things that we do know. We know that there is going to be an increase in hotel rooms, a legacy of the event. So we need to make every effort to keep these rooms filled after the event. Therefore, it would be necessary for us to start working with the property owners to see how we can work collectively to ensure that occupancies remain high. This calls for strategic marketing initiatives, increasing the airlift and ensuring that our service delivery remains at extremely high levels. We also know, Mr. Speaker, that a legacy of the Cricket World Cup will be the enhanced skills of our people in the service, construction and entertainment sectors. These newfound skills will be available to enhance our productivity. With productivity gains, this country can move the productivity portion to higher levels. And I dare say, Mr. Speaker, this will serve us well in a CSME environment. Another legacy that will benefit this country is the improvement in some of our major sporting facilities. This will undoubtedly enhance our ability to become a sports center in the region, serving as an attraction for regional and international sporting events, especially cricket. Our national security and health and emergency services systems and infrastructure will also be significantly enhanced as a result of the investments that will be made for Cricket World Cup. The positive impacts of these improvements will be felt and appreciated both within our resident population as well as in the tourism sector. So, are we going to have a hard or soft landing? I suggest, Mr. Speaker, that the answer to that question depends on us. If we seize the opportunities, if we are bold and make timely policy interventions, I believe that we will have a soft landing. Cricket World Cup, Mr. Speaker, will place heavy and extraordinary demands, not only on our infrastructure, but also on the availability of our services. One sector that will come under severe pressure is the car rental subsector. I'm advised by the Association of Independent Automobile Owners that the current combined fleet of the members of the association is approximately 600 vehicles. They estimate that the existing fleet should be increased to 750 vehicles to meet the expected demand during and after Cricket World Cup. The government is also concerned that there is equity of treatment across the subsectors in the tourism industry. Concessions have already been extended to hotels, bed and breakfast providers, and of course taxi drivers, all in the build-up to Cricket World Cup. Having reviewed the expected demand, government has agreed to a 100% waiver of import duty and excise tax on the purchase of new vehicles by companies and individuals engaged in the car rental sector, subject to the following terms and conditions. So, Mr. Speaker, to translate, the government will waive 100% duty and excise tax on vehicles to be imported by the car rental subsectors to facilitate them during Cricket World Cup. The terms and conditions. The concessions will apply only to vehicles purchased and landed in St. Lucia during the period May 15, 2006 to February 28, 2007. It is a limited concession. It ends on February 28, 2007. Purchasers will be required to pay service charge and environmental levy on the vehicles as required by law. Car rental operators must, one, be declared approved operators by the Ministry of Tourism and be in existence as of April 25th, 2006. That is today's date. You have to be in the business as of today. Confirm the use of the vehicles purchased or imported exclusively in the car rental sector. And three, retain vehicles that are granted the concessions for a minimum period of 3 years. Thereafter, the vehicles may be sold without the payment of import duty and excise tax. Any breach of these conditions will render a defaulting operator liable to the payment of the import duty and excise tax foregone. Speak up. I wish to touch on an issue that has attracted considerable concern, and that is rather the length and breadth of institution. I refer to the ongoing assessments for property tax. I wish to emphasize the following. Property tax legislation has been in existence since 1950. This government did not invent property tax legislation. Up until 2001, and I want to emphasize this for the benefit of the member for Babuno, homeowners, depending on whether they lived, depending on where they lived, paid one of three rates of property tax, 7%, 8%, or 14% on the assessed rental value of their properties. And you paid the highest rate, 14%, if you lived within the city boundaries. In 2001, Mr. Speaker, this government reduced the rate of property tax to a single rate of 5%. So instead of three rates, 7%, 8%, or 14%, this government reduced, in respect of homeowners, the rate to 5%. I repeat, Mr. Speaker, this government reduced the rates that were inherited. This government, Mr. Speaker, exempted three categories of persons from the payment of property tax. And I repeat them again. Persons who qualify as pensioners as defined in the National Insurance Act. So once you reach the retired age of pension, as defined by the NIS, you do not pay property tax. First-time homeowners who carry a mortgage, those who are exempted from property tax depending on the value of the mortgages. They will either be totally exempted or receive a rebate. If you go to a bank, you have a mortgage, you are a young person, for the first 3 years, if you have a mortgage, I believe up to $200,000, you get a total exemption, 100% of your property tax. Crucially, Mr. Speaker, persons whose household income is less than $6,000 do not pay and will not pay property tax. Those things were not there before. This government introduced those provisions, Mr. Speaker, and for ease of reference, I want to draw the attention of honorable members to Section 7 of the Land and House Tax Act, Chapter 15, 13 of the Revised Law Solution. So, Mr. Speaker, how then does a poor person owning a small house end up paying property tax? The simple fact is that if a family owns a property, and if a family earns less than $6,000 per year, then that family does not pay property tax. Further, Mr. Speaker, there is provision in the law to grant the waiver of property tax on the basis of poverty. If you are not caught within the $6,000 bracket and you feel that you are mad in poverty otherwise, there are other factors, you can in fact apply for a waiver of property tax. I repeat for emphasis, Mr. Speaker, the exemptions just outlined were introduced by this government. All of these provisions are enacted, again I repeat, in Section 7 of the Land and House Tax Act, Chapter 15, Number 13 of the Revised Laws of St. Lucia. There is one other aspect that I wish to address. In the 2003-2004 budget address, I announced that government would further amend the Land and House Tax Ordinance to exempt all pensioners from the payment of property tax once their sole source of income is a pension. The amendment has not yet been enacted, and I pledge to ensure that it is done in this parliamentary session. In other words, Mr. Speaker, persons who are public, who were public officers, and who are in receipt of, or who are, sorry, in receipt of a pension from the government because their pensions would not be paid by the NIS, they will be brought on the list and they will be treated like NIS pensioners and they will not be required to pay property tax. Mr. Speaker, I do understand the anxieties about the assessment. However, some who complain will in fact be exempted. The current exercise is necessary to determine who qualifies to pay property tax and who ought to be exempted. So you need to do the assessments. You need to go out. You need, Mr. Speaker, to find out if there are householders earning $6,000 a year or less. You need to determine who, for example, are first-time owners of property and have a mortgage. You need to do all of those things, Mr. Speaker. That is why the assessments are vital. I do regret, Mr. Speaker, that unfortunately those persons who are going out to conduct the assessments do not calm the fears and anxieties of homeowners by explaining to them that many of them would not in fact end up paying property taxes. It's unfortunate. It is only the assessments that will provide accurate information. Every citizen must remember that they have a right to appeal against any assessment conducted by designated officials of the Inland Revenue Department. And if you feel aggrieved, use it. Appeal the decision. I hope, Mr. Speaker, that this information, although already clearly stated in the 2001-2002 budget address, will assist parliamentarians to respond to the misinformation that is circulated by those whose sole objective in life is mischief. I sincerely hope that you will now be able to respond to these allegations. Mr. Speaker, in recent times, there has been considerable debate over the issue of minimum wage of persons employed in the construction sector. At present, there are no legislated minimum wages for construction workers, particularly laborers. The practice has been to pay laborers a wage based on the rates in the agricultural sector, although the market has been influencing rates in recent times. I'm informed that the Minister with Responsibility for Labor Relations, acting under the Minimum Wage Act, has appointed a commission to advise and make recommendations on all matters relating to the fixing of the minimum wage and terms and conditions of service. It will take some time before the commission submits its report to the minister. Meanwhile, government cannot allow inconsistency of rates to prevail, particularly in the construction sector. Indeed, the government can neither tolerate nor accept a situation where employees who are engaged in public sector contracts are paid rates below the accepted minimum rates. Pending the report of the Minimum Wage Commission, government has decided that in the interim, the issue of minimum wage for laborers on construction sites should be put beyond doubt. To that end, legislation will be introduced to establish the minimum wage for these workers at $55 per day. Legislation is currently before the House, and I would like to urge honorable members to give it their blessings in this session. Mr. Speaker, a frequent topic on our talk shows these past few weeks, not to mention the political platforms. Has been the issue of rising retail prices. No citizen is immune, and all have been affected. All kinds of reasons have been offered for this phenomenon. Some say it is because there is no competition in the supermarket business. There's a monopoly, it is said. Others blame the absence of price controls. Still others say that the increases in prices have to do with one thing, greed. Before I indicate what options are available, I want to spend a few minutes to explain the regime of taxes that applies to food items. Imported foods are subject to three taxes, namely import duty, consumption tax, and service charge. The environmental levy, contrary to what some believe, does not apply to food items. Consumers do not pay environmental levy on food items. So you need to be sure about that information. In other words, and I repeat, food items are exempted from the environmental levy. Next point. The rates of duty for all imported goods into St. Lucia are CARICOM-determined rates. We do not set these rates. They are set by CARICOM because all CARICOM states have a common rate of duty. Usually described as a common external tariff on goods originating outside of CARICOM. The objective is to protect goods produced in CARICOM. So the duty for food items, and you'll have some surprises in a few minutes, the duty on a lot of the imported merchandise, that duty is set by the common external tariff, and we are supposed to pay the same duty that is paid in Trinidad, in Barbados, in Jamaica, in Grenada, in Dominica, provided, of course, that all these governments are faithful to the common external tariff. The objective, as I said, Mr. Speaker, is to protect goods produced in CARICOM. We cannot change these rates of duty without seeking and obtaining the approval of CARICOM, specifically COTET. Then, Mr. Speaker, there is a regime of consumption tax. The consumption tax, introduced in St. Lucia in 1968, initially as a stamp duty, is a domestic tax which applies to all goods on a non-discriminatory basis. In recent years, it has been adjusted upwards in order to compensate for losses in revenue arising from the changes in duty. So, Mr. Speaker, when we went to the common external tariff, St. Lucia lost revenue because the tariffs were lowered, and the then government, which incidentally was a predecessor government, increased the consumption rate, quite rightly, and nothing is wrong with that, it's absolutely correct, increased the consumption tax rate so that we may recover the duty which we lost in the conversion to the CARICOM introduced rates of duty. Some items like potatoes, garlic, some peas and beans do not attract any consumption taxes. Others do. And the rates may vary from 0 to 5%, 5 to 15%, and exceptionally and very rarely, 0 to 25%. One commodity group that has attracted considerable interest in recent times is milk and dairy products. Several citizens have approached me, whether in the supermarket or privately, to complain about recent increases in the price of milk. However, honorable members would be surprised to know The government charges no duty on milk and milk products. There is, however, a 5% consumption tax, but no duty. And in fact, Mr. Speaker, contrary to the popular belief, the increases in the price of milk and milk products have little or nothing to do with increases in duty. Service charge, Mr. Speaker, applies to all goods entering St. Lucia and was introduced in 1989. This government did not introduce service charge. Did not introduce it. We met it. Currently, it is set at 5%. When determined the respective rates, the challenge for any Minister of Finance is to balance the rates in such a way as to enhance the opportunities available to local producers while simultaneously safeguarding the interests of the consumer. Take an item like tomato ketchup. The duty imposed on this commodity is 30%. If Chinacom had to reduce the duty on tomato ketchup, then ketchup imported from outside of CARICOM would become cheaper, competing directly not only with balanced ketchup and other locally produced ketchup, but with all other ketchup produced in CARICOM. The same applies to chicken parts, and I'm going to come back to that in a minute, Mr. Speaker. Chicken is a staple in our diet. If government decided for whatever reason to reduce the CARICOM imposed rates of duty on whole chicken, and notice, Mr. Speaker, I'm speaking about whole chicken, not chicken parts, because surprise, surprise, there's no duty on chicken parts, and I'll come to that shortly. Then we might as well say goodbye to locally produced whole chicken, because the imported chicken would become considerably cheaper than our locally produced chicken. So if you reduce the duty on imported whole chicken, if you reduce that, then there's a real danger it is going to become even more cheaper, and the pressure is going to be on the local farmers involved in the poultry industry. Emphasis, Mr. Speaker, I repeat. Interestingly, the government does not charge or impose any import duty on chicken backs, wings or legs. Only consumption taxes apply. There is, Mr. Speaker, one other myth that I wish to expose. Contrary to the popular view, price controls do not prevent increases in the retail prices of commodities. People believe that if you impose price control, then what will happen is that the prices will not go up. That's not the reality. Price controls normally limit the profit markups that a retailer is allowed to enjoy. Thus, if the importer is compelled to pay more for the items from abroad, for example, because the cost of fuel has increased, then the price of the items will still show increases on the shelves, even though the profit margin is controlled. Put it crudely, Mr. Speaker. Put it crudely. If in January you imported merchandise and you paid for it at $500, the markup allowed was 10% CIF. However, if in April that same item moves from $500 to $1,000, you still keep the profit markup at 10%, then you know the price is still going to go up despite the fact that you're keeping the markup the same thing. Mr. Speaker, I do not wish to downplay the challenges that face us. They are real. Everywhere in the region, governments are contended with increases in the cost of living. Earlier in my presentation, I pointed out that every government has had to contend with rising inflation. And I gave you the figures, Mr. Speaker. There is no doubt that increases in the price of fuel are primarily, and I'm not saying exclusively, are primarily responsible for this inflationary spiral. The price of fuel has led to higher costs of production and, expectedly, higher shipping costs. As long as the price of fuel continues to increase, so too will the price of imported goods. And so, Mr. Speaker, it is vital that we be vigilant during this period. How then do we deal with this situation? Our government, Mr. Speaker, will reduce the rate of consumption tax on a list of items. But because the rates are low, Mr. Speaker, the impact will not necessarily be dramatic. And I will repeat. Take chicken backs and necks. The import duty currently, Mr. Speaker, is 0%. There is no duty on chicken back and necks. The current consumption tax is 5%. I will reduce it to 0%. Chicken wings. There is no import duty on chicken wings. It is 0%. The current consumption tax is 5%. I will reduce it to 0%. Chicken thighs, breast, leg, quarters, and legs. Currently, the import duty is 0%. The consumption tax is 5%. I will reduce it to 0%. Chicken drumsticks. Import duty, again, 0%. We do not pay any import duty on it. Current consumption tax, 5%. I will reduce it to 0%. Turkey backs, necks and wings. Import duty on it, none at all, 0%. Current consumption tax, 5%. I will reduce it to 0%. Turkey drumsticks. Import duty currently 0%. No import duty. Current consumption tax 5%. I will reduce it to 0%. Evaporated milk. Current import duty on it 0%. As I indicated earlier on, the current consumption tax is 5%. I will reduce it. Sorry, it's 10%. Evaporated milk 0 import duty. Current consumption tax 10%. I will reduce it to 5%. Powdered milk. Import duty is 0%. Current consumption tax 10%, I will reduce it to 0%. Red kidney beans, and I'm not so sure why the rate of duty introduced by CARICOM on red kidney beans is so high. That is an intriguing one, and I'm told by the Minister of Agriculture that it may have to do with Belize. But the import duty is 40% for red kidney beans. The current consumption tax is 5%. I shall reduce it to 0%. Disposable baby diapers, import duty is 0%. Current consumption tax is 30%. That will go down to 5%. Canned tuna fish, current import duty is 5%. Current consumption tax 10%. I shall reduce it to 5%. Canned mackerel, import duty is 5%. And again, low, but I suspect the objective here is to protect CARICOM fishing output. Current consumption tax is 15%. I shall reduce it to 10% because we need to continue to ensure that we offer some degree of protection to our local fishermen. Canned sausages, import duty 30%. Again, CARICOM imposed. Current consumption tax 20%. I shall reduce this to 10%. Speaker, I will now turn from food to health to related subjects. Speaker, you have been hearing about universal health care in UAC for some time now. The UAC is truly a complementary program designed to operate in synergy within the existing health service. UAC will cover pharmaceuticals, hospital services, substance abuse rehabilitation services, mental health services, and overseas care. Consistent with this government's philosophy, UAC is predicated on the principles of social justice where no resident is left out. The UAC will dramatically improve the way that all health services are delivered. In order to learn some critical lessons, and in the interest of prudence, we have decided to approach the implementation of UAC in a phased manner. We are phasing it through the launch of some critical pilot programs, which shall permit us to learn some early lessons and take corrective action where necessary. Our test case is a pilot program of free treatment for persons suffering with diabetes and persons with diabetes accompanied by hypertension. This pilot is designed to deliver comprehensive outpatient care to diabetics, including access at no charge to anti-diabetes and anti-hypertension medications. We chose this disease to pilot our pharmaceutical package for a number of reasons, but primarily because of the burden of this disease. And Mr. Speaker, I want to indicate early that while I had in December originally announced that this pilot would have been introduced solely for pensioners, government has now decided to expand this to all individuals, that is to say, to cover persons who are currently in the workforce. In other words, all institutions will be covered. Diabetes, and you know what it means, Pisadu, is a major disease causing death and disability in St. Lucia. Our health statistics show that 124 persons are dying every year with diabetes identified as the principal cause of death, making it the number one leading cause of death. The damage that diabetes causes cannot be quantified only in terms of death, because diabetes is also a major contributor to persons losing their legs, becoming blind, and developing kidney disease. Our health officials estimate that 20% of St. Lucians over the age of 40 years suffer with diabetes. This translates into 8,000 people with diabetes and in need of care. Most alarming is that an estimated 50% of persons who are diabetic do not know they are diabetic. The true cost of diabetes is indeed staggering. Therefore, we are going to ensure that there is widespread screening for diabetes as part of the pilot. And I want to urge each and every one of you in this chamber this afternoon, as well as every institution, to undergo the free screening for diabetes that will be available. We also know that many among us have to struggle to get their medications to manage this illness. Indeed, we know that many quite often have to go without vital medication because they cannot afford it. This pilot, Mr. Speaker, will eliminate that problem for diabetics. As part of this pilot, we are going to aggressively promote healthy diets and regular exercise, which is a strategy that will assist us in reducing the impacts of many other diseases and illnesses. These lifestyle practices should be implemented by all of us. The diet which we shall promote is one where we consume more vegetables and fruits, more ground provisions, more yam, more dashin, more peas and beans, less saturated fats, oils, and less animal products. This creates a synergy between agriculture and health. Mr. Speaker, I am simply saying we need to produce and consume more of our own local produce, not only because it is good for our local economy, but because it is healthy. After this particular pilot, which will end in 9 months, we will continue the medications for diabetics and will introduce other elements of the UHC pharmaceutical package, which will include medication for all persons with asthma, for cancer patients, for patients with various infections, pain medication, and many others. Truly, Mr. Speaker, a revolution in health has commenced. Our overall goal is to have a health system that plays its part in ensuring that people are productive and contributors to national health, national wealth and development because they are mentally, socially and physically well. We intend to forge ahead with the implementation of universal health care and the other proposed health reforms because this is a government that is focused on people, a government that cares about its people, and a government that understands what its people need. And Mr. Speaker, we're not going back to no NHS. Mr. Speaker, for many of our citizens, certain parts of the city of Castries have become unattractive, unappealing, and unsafe. The areas to the east of Pioneer Street and to the south of Preserve Street spring to mind because the signs of decay are very visible. This is reflected in an increase in dilapidated buildings, crumbling street infrastructure, especially sidewalks and drains, and unplanned and unsightly developments. The city too is becoming dysfunctional. The flow of pedestrians and vehicular traffic, I remember from Groseley, is timed by sidewalk vendors on the one hand and haphazard street parking on the other. Urgent and concerted action is required to present a more appealing and functional city to the thousands of residents who use it on a daily basis and the tens of thousands of visitors who grace our shores every year. The challenge is both short-term and long-term. One of the long-term solutions has to do with the rejuvenation of certain communities within the Castries Basin. Let us start with this. Mr. Speaker, in the 2005 Stone speech, Her Excellency the Emperor Louis Yeo, Governor General, addressed the overcrowding and this indiscriminate squatting in the Castries Basin and its satellite communities. Her Excellency stated government policy this way. Mr. President, Mr. Speaker, it is well known, and I'm quoting, that there is tremendous overcrowding in the Castries Basin and surrounding urban areas. This is the unfortunate result of years of spontaneous and unplanned expansion of residential communities. It is also the result of urban drift and indiscriminate squatting. In many cases, this has led to intolerable social conditions and dangerous physical conditions, unauthorized construction, poor drainage, land slippage, and worse. It is now vital that there be a systematic rationalization of such settlements to bring relief to residents and improve prospects for poverty reduction and wealth creation through the acquisition of land ownership and title. Accordingly, my government will during this year commence a resettlement program in Conway. Thereafter, similar processes will be undertaken in other communities based on economic and social analysis of existing conditions and determination of resident profiles. These tasks will be undertaken by the Ministry of Physical Development, Environment and Housing. Given the extent of the problems to be tackled, these processes are likely to be complex and lengthy and will require patience on all sides. In fact, that zone speech, Your Excellency, indicated that government's policy was to move towards acquisition of properties, certain properties within the Castries Basin. Plans are well on the way to commence the resettlement of Conway residents, and this financial year should see the commencement, Honourable Member for Groseley, of construction of infrastructure on the selected site of relocation. The problems in the wider Castries Basin are, however, more complex. Many of the residents live on properties rented from landlords, spanning in many cases several generations. Citizens turn to central government for help, but sometimes the government is unable to respond because the land is in private ownership. In some areas, it is impossible to improve access because of the location of homes. Overcrowding has led to unacceptable and intolerable social conditions. The first step in tackling these issues is for the government to gain unimpeded access and ownership of the properties in question. Government therefore proposes to acquire these properties from their owners. Once this is done, the process of rationalization can commence. This will entail improvement and extension of existing infrastructure, the grant of title and ownership of the land occupied by existing families on terms and conditions to be offered by the government, and the relocation of some residents to approved areas. Given the sheer scale and cost of this initiative, implementation will take time and necessarily must be phased. The government will approach this challenge as follows. First, the lands to be acquired will be identified and acquired in phases commencing this financial year. Two, prior to acquisition, the government will hold discussions with the owners or the representatives of the owners. Three, this initiative will be managed by the Program for the Regularization of Unplanned Developments, PROUD, a unit already established in the Ministry of Physical Development, Environment and Housing. PROUD will be expanded and strengthened to cope with this new responsibility. Initially, PROUD will have to capture information and data about the residents. PROUD will be multidisciplinary in composition, outlook and skills. Where relocation, and this is point four, is necessary to facilitate the construction of infrastructure, government will identify sites for relocation of the persons likely to be affected. Mr. Speaker, the government has already identified the following communities for attention: Fuasho, Manan, Bagatelle, Cedars, Mondragon, Marsha, Georgeville. Other communities will be added once the preliminary studies are completed. I want to make it quite clear that this is not an exhaustive list. It is simply that the research has to be ongoing. Acquisition of the areas in question will be phased over a cycle of 3 to 5 years. Speaker, I wish to make it abundantly clear that until such time the government acquires these properties, the owners are entitled to render payment from the persons to whom they are leasing. Maria Pio, Mr. Speaker. Peace, Ubazmadi, Ikai, Ashche, Sepla, Sala, Fugade, Si, Isa, Faipo, Si, Pumunj, Wen. Placida ko yo ka wete pou kome lane, se pou yo kompon touta gouvernman pa achete, yo ni pou kontinue peye, se moun na ki met se teya pou teya yo ka lwea. Pa dougout peye, se moun sa pisoutan gouvernman di, i kay se mouvman pou achete se placida la, pis gouvernman di kon sa. Moun vou bien kompon, avan i fe tout sa, ini pou ni diskosyon, e vi se met se teya sa, api se placida la. Prime Minister, the pay rental. Over the years, Mr. Speaker, there has been a noticeable and steady deterioration of the sidewalks in Castries, much to the distress of citizens. Some effort has been made to effect repairs to sections of the city, but at best, these efforts have been sporadic and piecemeal. Our government now proposes to undertake a comprehensive program of reconstruction and rehabilitation of the city sidewalks during this financial year. I propose to allocate $2.3 million to this program. I have no doubt that this program will enhance the general appearance of the city and restore some of its legendary charm and appearance, particularly in those areas where no rehabilitation has taken place. The implementation of this program will be the shared responsibility of the Ministry of Communications, Works, Transport and Public Utilities and the Castries City Council. Mr. Speaker, we recognize that the first image that our visitors get when approaching our city, whether by boat, plane or car, is the waterfront. The Castries waterfront has a long history of welcoming visitors and in times past was admired as one of the most beautiful ports in the region. It is so sad, Mr. Speaker, so sad that Prince Alfred Basin no longer exists. So very sad. But alas, that number for Sufre. But alas, we can no longer boast that the waterfront is as welcoming to the eyes as before. The only recent development of the waterfront has been the construction of the two phases of La Place Caradage by Slatsov. This duty-free shopping mall, along with the recently completed Desmond Skeith Animation Center, represent only the beginning of the realization of the potential for the development of the entire waterfront. So in order to continue this development, SLASFA, along with subsidiary Anchorage Investments Limited, The National Insurance Corporation and its subsidiary, National Insurance Property Development and Management Company, and the Bank of St. Lucia have come together to formulate a strategy for the redevelopment of the Cass Street waterfront. Interestingly, Mr. Speaker, two non-national entities have also expressed an interest in participating in the redevelopment of the Cass Street waterfront. One of these entities is in the cruise industry. The prospects for this development are interesting and exciting. Permit me to share with this Honourable House some of the ideas that have been discussed so far. The area under consideration encompasses the entire waterfront area from the former Castries Yacht Centre to Shared Spawn 5 along Lower Jeremy Street. The proposed development will be modular in nature, and it is proposed that the following modules will be pursued. 1. Castries Yacht Centre, Ganters Bay, up to the Tender's Jetty adjacent to the restaurant Froggy Jack's. Most of the land in that area is owned by Slasper and the Crown, and it is proposed that the area be developed into an upscale condominium complex and a yacht facility with restaurants. 2. Point Serpent, the reef and the access road to the Point Serpent shopping complex. Some portions of the land in this area are also owned by the Crown and NDC. It is proposed that this area is to be developed to cater to a mix of tourism, commercial and entertainment related activities. 3. The final module would involve a stretch of property along Jeremy Street, including the Vendors Arcade, the Port Police and Fire Stations, the Place Carinan, the Customs and Excise Building, and Shed Spawn 5. It is proposed that this area be developed to enhance the shopping experience for citizens and visitors. Already, a committee comprising board and council members of the NIC and SLASPA and other interests have been established to pursue the most appropriate corporate development model. Speaker, given the excitement that has been generated by the relevant parties, I'm of the firm view that this venture merits the support of the government of St. Lucia, and we will certainly want to offer any assistance to bring this idea to fruition, including the grant of all the incentives that are necessary. Meanwhile, Mr. Speaker, government will proceed with one aspect of upgrading the waterfront. Our government recently commissioned a Castries Urban Transportation Study, and the consultants who prepared the report have suggested that, quote, a waterfront promenade can provide an opportunity to link Point Serpent with the city centre, making it an integral experience for locals and visitors alike. The promenade should provide an arena-like experience to users with ample vistas of the harbour and special pavilions along its way to enhance the experience, unquote. In the view of the consultants, the promenade can and should be the signature structure of the downtown waterfront and part of an attractive, welcoming approach to the city of Castries. The promenade would express the unique character and beauty of Port Castries. Construction of a promenade along the Castries waterfront can give citizens the opportunity to realize both old and new dreams for the water sporting events which took place in the harbor long ago. Government has accepted this recommendation and decided to construct a tree-lined shaded promenade boardwalk extending northward from within the existing craft market along the waterfront to the small vehicular bridge adjacent to the St. Lucia Electricity Services building at San Susi. The proposal will be the first step in a dramatic waterfront improvement. It will stand as a symbol of revitalization and triumph for an entire section of the city. I expect this will be done in time for Cricket World Cup in 2007. Honourable members may wish to note that a sum of $6.25 million has been allocated in the estimate to finance the construction of the promenade. Mr. Speaker, it is vital that Castries reflect the image of a rapidly developing city. While we witness the refurbishment of buildings within the commercial section, we also observe a proliferation of clear vending along our sidewalks that stands in stark contrast to the profile that needs to be created of the city. This is aesthetically incompatible. But our vendors must be provided an opportunity to earn a living. They must feed and educate their children too. So, Mr. Speaker, government must intervene and assist them in plying their trade in an organized and orderly manner. Consequently, this year, I have instructed the National Development Corporation to work with the Castries City Council to conduct an assessment of the vendor situation in Castries. Upon completion, the National Development Corporation will make available a sum of EC $300,000 to construct quality vending carts or stalls that can maintain the aesthetic beauty of the city. Castries Market, Mr. Speaker, is unquestionably one of the oldest and most noticeable features of the landscape of the city of Castries. For decades, it has assumed prominence not only as an environment that facilitated income-generating opportunities for vendors and the farming community alike, but just as critically, as a major tourism asset. It is also a political asset, for it is the undisputed home of the St. Lucia Labour Party, St. Lucia's first university, so to speak. The market complex, which comprises the Vendors Arcade, the Provisions Market and the Arts and Crafts Old Market, accommodates 388 vendors in total. Over the years, it has been patronized by hundreds of thousands of tourists and locals. Its value to our people and our economy, indeed its overall intrinsic value, cannot be underestimated. Despite an ongoing maintenance by the Castries City Council, this facility has deteriorated to the point where it now adversely affects the integrity of the products offered by the vendors, thereby compromising their overall ability to sustain their economic activity. The intrusion of the elements, both sun and rain, has exposed the fragility of the current drainage and roofing systems in particular. Moreover, the prevailing on-site conditions are significantly diminishing the historical and aesthetic value of the market complex as they act as deterrents to those seeking to patronize the facility. Our city, with all its architecture, must exude confidence, vibrancy, freshness, and aesthetic appeal, and the market complex can play a lead role in catalyzing this transformation. An allocation of $300,000 has therefore been made available to enable the Castries City Council to undertake urgent upgrading works to the complex. The major works to be implemented include the installation of extractor fans and drainage works in the Arts and Crafts Market, the upgrading of the guttering system in the Provisions Market, and the installation of down pipes, as well as drainage and roofing works in the Vendors Arcade. I am particularly pleased for those vendors who occupy the arcade because they have had to endure from the inception a facility with inherent design deficiencies. They have in the past complained loudly and deserve some relief. I shall now, Mr. Speaker, address the government's investment program in the social sector. This fiscal year, the government will bring to fruition a long-standing promise to construct a new citizen's home in Beaufort. The existing senior citizen's home in Malbitut is an old, dilapidated structure. It has been in poor condition for some time. Government officials have long advised that given the condition of the facility, it would be more cost-effective to construct a brand new facility than to attempt to renovate the present structure. The government has accepted this advice and will build a modern home for the elderly from the proceeds of the sale of the existing site. For many years, different prospective investors have advanced plans for hotel development in Malbitut, the site where the existing senior citizens' home is located. But nothing, absolutely nothing materialized. But it was not until last year that serious negotiations were entered into for the sale of the land. The hotel developers, who had already acquired some of the adjoining private land, approached the government to purchase the Malbitut site comprising 8 acres for construction of a 5-star hotel and residential resort. The proposed development includes a marina, charter facility, a marina key, and a condominium. In order to satisfy itself that it obtained the best possible price for the land, the government commissioned 5 valuations of the property, 4 of which came from independent persons in the private sector. In the end, The government agreed to sell 8 acres of land on the basis of the highest valuation, that is $8,655,046. Government will utilize the proceeds of the sale towards the construction of a new modern facility in Opica, Beaufort, on lands already earmarked for that purpose. The new facility will have the capacity to accommodate 2.5 times the population of the existing home. The Malvitude home presently accommodates 60 persons, while the new senior citizen home will house at least 150. The stated intention of government in undertaking this project is to design and build a modern facility through which the standard and quality of care provided to our senior citizens can be improved now and in the future. Consequently, the new senior citizens' home will be outfitted with modern amenities for the assurance of the comfort and well-being of our senior citizens. We cannot allow our senior citizens to live in the dehumanizing conditions that currently obtain at Malvitude 2. It is time for us to right yet another wrong. The cost of the new citizens' home is estimated at approximately $13.5 million. In this financial year, a sum of $8.6 million is allocated for the commencement of construction. This project is expected to be completed within 2 years. Since 2000, Mr. Speaker, the government has repaired or rebuilt approximately 171 homes of elderly persons, some of whom have been abandoned by their families, at a cost of $1 million. We do have a huge problem in our society. Too many families are simply abandoning their foreparents, their parents, and leaving them alone to fend for themselves, a matter we need to address and to correct. The total number of houses repaired or rebuilt from the inception of the program is as follows. In 2000-2001, 73. In 2001-2002, 20. In 2002-2003, 49. In 2003-2004, 29, making a total of 171. In this financial year, I propose to allocate $500,000 to this program so as to allow for a continuation of this much-needed support for our senior citizens, many of whom are no longer able to fend for themselves. Speaker, as we move to universal secondary education, we will still have disadvantaged and marginalized youth in our midst. Many of these young persons were not able to secure places in secondary schools, but that, as you heard, will be no more come September 2006. These young persons are extremely vulnerable and at risk. It is important, therefore, that special programs are provided to these individuals, so that they can be equipped with the necessary skills to find employment. In this regard, I wish to commend the excellent work being undertaken by the Center for Adolescent Renewal and Education, or CARE as it is known. Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Government of St. Lucia, I wish to express my appreciation to the founders of that institution. CARE offers a 2-year program to students at 5 centers in Catrice, Vigy, Ansiri, Grosley, and Souffre. The training culminates with a 6-week job training experience. A large percentage of the students are immediately employed after job training, and 85% of the trainees find gainful employment. This is a commendable record and performance. There are currently 300 trainees, of whom 60% are boys and 40% are girls, with ages ranging from 15 to 19 years. The majority of the students who enroll at CARE have parents with limited financial resources. The finances of CARE come from the students who pay $200 per term, benevolent benefactors, and government. Mr. Speaker, in recognition of the excellent work being undertaken by CARE, I propose to increase their subvention by $100,000 to $300,000 annually. Honourable members will recall that Parliament recently amended the Electricity Supply Act No. 10 of 1994 to provide that in cases where Lucilec enjoys a rate of return in any financial year that is higher than their allowable rate of return, then 50% of the excess may be applied in proportion to each kilowatt hour consumed by industrial and hotel consumers, and at the determination of the minister to consumers or groups of consumers in need of special protection. Lucilec has now advised that the excess available for redistribution in the 2005 financial year is $4.1 million. I want to just allow that to sink in. Lucilec has said that the excess that is available for redistribution is $4.1 million. Question is, how do we distribute this $4.1 million? With the recent amendments to the Act, the industrial and hotel consumers will benefit automatically, and it now falls to determine the group of consumers in need of special protection. This is a responsibility assigned to the Minister by the Act. In arriving at a decision, the Minister, who incidentally happens to be the Minister for Finance, was mindful of the fact that the current tariff arrangements require the manufacturing and tourism sectors to pay higher tariffs than ordinary consumers. Indeed, it has been argued that the economic sectors are in effect subsidizing ordinary consumers. The tariff arrangements have also from time to time drawn steam criticism from the private sector. According to the private sector, the cost of electricity impacts on their competitiveness, a view which routinely earns them the support of the IMF. It is imperative, too, that the manufacturing sector is positioned to meet the inevitable challenges that the CSME will bring. Having considered all the factors, the Minister has decided to apply part of the amount available for redistribution to the most vulnerable sections of our population, that is, householders using up to 108 units of electricity per month. In other words, the poorer sections of our community. This means that effective from the month after the order is published in the Gazette, consumers in this category, who total almost 31,000 persons in number, should see a reduction in their monthly bills. The formula for the redistribution contained in the Act is based on units of electricity consumed in the previous year. And the relevant kilowatt hours for 2005 are, and this is just for information if you care for it, hotels and industrial 69,406,473, domestic up to 180 units, that is the group that we are targeting, 32,539,480 kilowatt hours, making a grand total of 101,945,953. This equates to 4.02 cents per unit, equivalent to a 5.07% decrease for the hotels and industrials, and a 6.25% decrease for domestic consumers using up to 108 units per month. This means that 2.8 million of the 4.1 million will go to the industrial and hotel consumers, and the balance of 1.3 million will go to that group identified to be in need of special protection. However, I must emphasize again, that if the price of oil continues to rise, consumers may not enjoy this relief for very long. We all have to hope that sanity returns to the oil market and the price of oil stabilizes. The price of oil continues to rise, we will still feel the inevitable pressures that it unleashes. Mr. Speaker, I have spoken at length about the burden of high oil prices. St. Lucia needs to make adjustments in energy policy to minimize the effects of these high prices. Part of the response has to do with encouraging our citizens to invest in energy-saving devices. We must begin to prepare for the inevitable, and we must do so now. Our plea to everybody, you have to take this issue seriously. Can't continue on this folly of consuming electricity, because for us it means that the bills will continue to increase and increase and increase. I have had the opportunity to review initiatives elsewhere in the region and propose to adopt some to our use and circumstances. Mr. Speaker, there is currently a housing boom in St. Lucia. I, however, wish to urge St. Lucians to pay special attention in designing their homes, especially in relation to using materials that keep houses cooler. These materials include window tint, ceramic roof coating, roof insulation, and thermal barriers. I propose to reduce the rate of import duty on these items, subject, of course, to approval of CARICOM, which generally attract a rate ranging from 15% to 20% to a rate of 5%. In so doing, Mr. Speaker, I hope that homeowners will choose their building materials wisely. Mr. Speaker, we tend to be very wasteful in the use of energy in our homes, incurring significant and sometimes unnecessary energy costs. I want to encourage St. Lucians to be more economical in the use of energy by carrying out home audits. Doesn't matter how small the home is, but it's worth doing the audits. Each household will require different advice depending on their respective energy needs. In order to encourage home energy audits and conservation systems that are recommended as a result of the audit, I wish to propose that up to $2,500 be allowed as a one-off tax deduction from accessible income to persons who undertake such audits of their properties and implement the recommendations of the audit in the year that the deduction is claimed. So if you have a home, you want to find out what to do to reduce your energy costs, you ask that an audit be done, and you may have to pay for the audit, but you may have to shift, for example, to floors and bulb, and you have expenditure, then you can claim $2,500 from your taxes for that specific year in which you do the audit. The Ministry of Communications, Works, Transport and Public Utilities will develop the criteria for approval and certification of the auditors. A significant percentage of a household electricity consumption is from the use of light bulbs. Many households continue to use incandescent bulbs rather than fluorescent bulbs, despite the fact that the latter is up to 5 times more energy efficient than the former. In an effort to encourage households to switch to fluorescent bulbs, I propose to reduce the import duty rate on fluorescent bulbs, again with the approval of CARICOM, which carries the same rate as incandescent bulbs, from 20% to 5%. It is evident, Mr. Speaker, that high gas prices are here to stay. As supplies dwindle, gas prices are likely to continue to increase. It is therefore important for us to be futuristic. Let us look to the future now and encourage the use of vehicles that are run on alternative energy sources. In keeping with this vision, Mr. Speaker, I propose that new hybrid vehicles, as well as those powered by whatever form of new energy, whether it be solar engine, LPG, and compressed natural gas, will attract a flat excise tax rate of 15%, irrespective of engine size, as compared to the lowest rate of 20.5% on regular cars. I hope, Mr. Speaker, that this concession will encourage an enterprising car dealer to explore the possibility of importing such vehicles into St. Lucia, as it is well known Toyota, Honda, and of course Brazil all producing hybrid cars now. Government is also willing to enter into discussions with the Petroleum Dealers Association to consider options for retrofitting existing fuel stations to cater to these hybrid vehicles. And indeed, government is prepared to enter into discussions with any dealer who is interested in moving in that direction. Speaker, owners of diesel vehicles tend to spend less money on fuel than older than equally sized gasoline vehicles. Older than diesel vehicles get better value for money because they get more mileage per dollar.
Please, I would like to have the Honorable Minister of Finance.
I do want you to have him, Mr. Speaker. At present, diesel and gasoline vehicles are subject to the same levels of excise tax. I propose to effect a change to the excise tax regime by introducing a separate and new tariff for diesel-powered vehicles. Effective June 1, 2006, the foreign excise tax regime will apply to diesel-powered vehicles. Diesel coaches and buses not exceeding 21 passengers, the current excise tax is 33.75%, 33.75, I propose to reduce it to 20%. Diesel coaches and buses exceeding 21 but less than 29 passengers, the current excise tax is 23.75%, I propose to reduce it to 15%. Coaches have a capacity exceeding 29 passengers. Currently, the current excise tax is 23.75%. I propose to reduce it to 15%. Other diesel motor vehicles with compression, the current excise tax is 33.75%. I propose to reduce it to 20%. Diesel motor cars less than 1,500 cc, the current excise tax is 23.75%. I propose to reduce it to 15%. Diesel motor cars exceeding 1,500 cc, but less than 2,000 cc, the current excise tax is 50.75%. I propose to reduce it to 40%. Diesel motor cars exceeding 2,000 cc, but less than 2,500 cc, of course that's the cars the big shots like to buy, huh? The current excise tax is 65%. I shall reduce it to 50%. Diesel motor cars exceeding 2,500 cc, the current excise tax is 65%, I shall reduce it to 50%. Other diesel cars designed principally for transportation, the current excise tax is 65%, I shall reduce it to 50%. Diesel trucks and pickups not exceeding 5 tons, the current excise tax is 55%, I shall reduce it to 40%. Mr. Speaker, slowly but surely, steps have been taken to develop an entertainment industry in St. Lucia. Mr. Speaker, a strong plea has been made to government to encourage artists and entertainers to invest in the recording business. The technology for recording is largely digitized and readily accessible. I have decided to respond positively to this request and have agreed to a waiver of import duty on consumption taxes on a range of equipment required for recording studios. The list of equipment is itemized in Appendix 1 to the budget, Mr. Speaker. It includes sound modules, headphones, microphones, software, power amplifiers, studio monitor speakers, pre-amplifiers, amplifiers, sound processors, sound cards, mixers, patch bays, compressors, effect modules, DI boxes, equalizers, racks, soundproofing material, MIDI controller, musical instruments, digital audio workstation, and I think there is something called the ESSA, etc. Applications for these concessions should be channeled to the Minister for Finance through the Ministry of Social Transformation, Culture and Local Government, which should be required to confirm that the applicant is genuinely involved in the recording business. Should the duty-free equipment be used for a purpose other than recording, then the beneficiary will be required to meet the duty liability on the equipment. And I might add that the Customs Department is astoundingly efficient in checking on these concessions. Many persons who have abused other concessions have had the items taken away from them. Meanwhile, the Cultural Department or the Cultural Development Foundation should proceed to develop the criteria and procedures to access this concession so that it could become operational by August 1st, 2006. Speaker, the government is aware that it is not always easy for artists and entertainers to access finance or projects that are expected to provide them with a stream of income. artists and entertainers are in a challenging business in which returns are uncertain. However, we cannot ignore the need to encourage the development of an entertainment industry, and we must think in terms of that direction, not only locally but beyond our borders into the region and elsewhere. The National Development Corporation has offered to develop, jointly with the Cultural Development Foundation, a pilot program to advance loans up to a limit of $5,000 to artists and entertainers to undertake income-generating projects. The terms, conditions, and procedures for accessing these loans will be finalized by the NDC and CDF. I expect the facility to be operational by July 1st, 2006. Mr. Speaker, unemployment hurts primarily our young people. This continues to be the case despite a significant reduction in unemployment these past 2 months. We must continue our efforts to re-educate, retool, and reskill. That responsibility is assigned to the National Skills Development Center. This financial year, Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased to advise honorable members that the NSDC will receive a total allocation of $3.72 million. Approximately $2 million of this amount will be made available to NSDC's program of skills training. This will supplement the amount allocated, Mr. Speaker, to the youth apprenticeship program. The NSDC has been authorized to target immediately some 700 persons for training in a variety of skills. I have requested NSDC to target communities where unemployment is particularly high. Training will be provided in the following areas: office administration, hospitality, bartending and waiting, housekeeping, electrical installation, masonry and steel bending, plumbing, early childhood development, preschool, tanning, tour guiding, sewing and drapery design, introduction to graphic design, electronic appliance repair, standard entry. Stipends will be provided to trainees to encourage the attendance in all training workshops. These stipends will be paid at a flat rate of $400 per trainee per month, inclusive of meal allowances. As announced in my New Year's address, the National Skills Development Center will initiate a program of training for young persons in the eastern and southern parts of the island for future employment in the tourism and hospitality sectors. The National Skills Development Center will initially target some 350 persons and will commence training this cohort towards the end of the year. An allocation of $1.2 million has been made for a human resource development program. This program, which is currently being finalized by the NLO's office in conjunction with the European Commission delegation, focuses on formal tertiary level training and informal entry level training, and follows the broad strategy developed for human resource development through skills training in rural sectors as outlined in the education strategy for 2005-2010. The program is designed as a long-term development approach, combining training with job search assistance and other employment services. This should assist in the creation of a more skilled and marketable labor force, better equipped to embrace the challenges of the Caribbean single market economy, the effects of globalization, and the contraction of the banana sector. The program, which has a three-year implementation period, has two main components. The first component offers pre-university certification at the Arthur Lewis Community College. Under this intervention, the Ministry of Education will determine the priority areas which will be supported. It is anticipated that between 150 and 200 young persons will benefit from this program. Upon completion of the training program, graduates will be encouraged to participate in the Youth Apprenticeship Program, YAP, and the Micro and Small Business Startup Capital and Funding from VELFUND and the OPSR. This component shall receive an allocation of $650,000. The third component of the program will support the ongoing youth apprenticeship program currently being undertaken by the NSDC. This component will seek to provide on-the-job training experience for 150 young persons over a period of 1 year. An allocation of $520,000 is earmarked for the app. The age group of 18-25 years is being targeted, as that age group has the highest unemployment rate. The project will be open to unemployed persons who have left the formal education and training system graduated from training with organizations such as NELP, CARE, NSDC, and graduates who have benefited from other HRD training programs. In addition to the above-mentioned initiatives for all young people, the government has allocated $3.5 million to sports development. Of this amount, $840,000 will be allocated to construction of new playing fields and upgrading of existing playing fields. A sum of $765,000 has been allocated to finance repairs to six multipurpose courts and the construction of two new courts at the Viewport Senior Secondary School campus, Bien Pavé. Additionally, $200,000 will be available to upgrade national sports facilities at the Minufita Park and Vigi Sports Complex to provide offices and facilities for national sporting organizations. Of the total allocation, a sum of $1.45 million is rebudgeted for the construction of the Souffre Brand stand. It is regrettable, Mr. Speaker, that this project has been delayed. But I want to assure the honorable member for Souffre that the government is patiently awaiting the completion of the designs for the facility. Small businesses play a critical role in increasing economic activity and reducing unemployment. This government has therefore established a number of programs and provided concessions to encourage the growth of small businesses. This year, Mr. Speaker, we have allocated a sum of $1.5 million to the Rural Small Business Credit Facility. Under this facility, $25,000 in grant funds will be made available per borrower to pay for services which are part of a business loan from a financial institution. Additionally, Mr. Speaker, our members may wish to note that the government will provide SLISPA with a subvention of $100,000 this financial year to assist its members in meeting their administrative costs. Mr. Speaker, I'm pleased to advise that during this fiscal year, the National Development Corporation, who finally began to play a more active role in national development, will make $250,000 available to persons who wish to engage in micro-business ventures with a capital cost of no more than $5,000 per person per project. This amount of $250,000 will be available and, depending on demand, may be supplemented to persons who wish to undertake viable micro-businesses, especially in preparation for Cricket World Cup. These funds will be jointly managed by the NDC and the James Delagrave Fund. Speaker, the people of Beaufort continue to search for ways and means to benefit from the tourism industry. The transformation of the former Club Med to Coconut Bay Hotel has enhanced the tourism potential of the community. Over the years, several persons have obtained a livelihood by vending their craft to tourists. The numbers have grown, and it is now necessary to provide them with a home. During the second quarter of this year, the National Development Corporation will undertake the construction of a modern vendor's arcade in close proximity to Huanora Airport and Coconut Bay Resort and Spa. The cost of this arcade is estimated at approximately $1.5 million. The people of Beaufort really have to take, huh? Mr. Speaker, seldom has a budget statement been presented in the last 9 years when there has not been some mention of support for the banana industry. Indeed, I have stated on many occasions that this administration has extended greater assistance to banana farmers than the other government in history, and I stand by that statement. Perhaps this is as good a time as any to review the level of support that we have provided to the banana industry since coming into office in 1997. Number one, this government wrote off $44 million of debt owed by the former St. Lucia Banana Growers Association, SLBGA, followed by the forgiveness of $700,000 of outstanding trade payables owed by the SLBGA. Two, to facilitate the emergence of an unincumbent private banana company fully owned by the farmers of this country, We secured $3.65 million from the European Commission for the retrenchment of SSBGS staff. Three. $16.3 million of European Commission grant funds were used to fund the banana production recovery plan, BRP, which was aimed at arresting the decline in banana production and farmer migration that had occurred prior to this government's assumption of office in 1997. Four, in order to stimulate improvements in the post-harvest handling of bananas and improve the overall quality of the fruit reaching the United Kingdom, government constructed three modern inland reception and distribution centers, IRDC, at a cost of $12.5 million. Five, between October 2000 and March 2001, $2.5 million was provided to fund leaf spot control. Six, at the end of 2000, $1.4 million was provided to the banana industry to facilitate a reduction in the price of banana cartons by a dollar. In April 2001, $3.5 million was made available by the government to the Banana Industry Trust for the establishment of a revolving input credit scheme. This was supplemented by a further amount of $3 million in 2005. Eight, government sought and obtained special leave from the European Commission to utilize funds under the 1995 SEDEX transfer, totaling approximately $2.5 million to finance leaf spot control activities between April 2001 and December 2001. Over $20 million was mobilized on the European Union Special Framework of Assistance 1999 and 2000 programs for the banana industry, primarily to allow for the installation of off-farm drainage and irrigation infrastructure in Roseau, Cul-de-sac, Mabuya Valley, Canals, and Marquis. And 10, this government has foregone significant revenue from import duties and taxes by providing 100% exemption of import duty on consumption tax to banana farmers on production inputs. Despite all this assistance, there are still some who, for selfish and short-sighted political gain, would have us believe that this government has killed the banana industry institutions. Not just him alone, huh? Not him alone at all. I am sure that there are many other industries that would beg a government to kill them with over $107 million in direct assistance and millions more in direct support over a 9-year period. But some persons have old habits of riding the backs of our farmers for personal gain, and for them these old habits die hard. Fact remains, Mr. Speaker, that the banana industry throughout the English-speaking Caribbean has taken a beating. And one only has to look at what has happened to production in Jamaica, Grenada, Dominica, and St. Vincent to understand that decline in production is a fact of life. Grenada has abandoned the banana industry. Production has declined in every single island. In fact, declines have been sharper and more severe in neighboring countries. So if this government has killed the banana industry in St. Lucia, then my goodness, it has also killed the industry in Dominica, St. Vincent, Grenada, and even as far as Jamaica. Can you imagine? Sometimes, Mr. Speaker, to hide our own shortcomings, we try to point out the deficiencies, rare or imagined, in others. And this appears to be the strategy being applied by our old friends with no ideas. We all know the Creole saying, Pwa nuva rava nuva po. Speaker, true to form, and consistent with our philosophy of doing all within our power to protect our banana farmers and give our industry every chance to survive in an increasingly harsh and competitive global marketplace. This year we will extend further support to the banana industry. Those of us familiar with the banana industry will know that one of the serious constraints to profitability is the cyclical pattern of rain-fed production. Simply put, when it rains, we get more production than we can market profitably, and during the dry season, we do not get the volumes that the market is demanding. We have high volumes when market prices are depressed, and insufficient production when market prices are favorable. This has been a feature of the banana industry for decades, yet nothing was done about it until this government took office in 1997. So far, using the provisions of the 1999 and 2000 SFA allocations, off-farm irrigation and drainage infrastructure has been installed in Roseau and Cul-de-Sac. However, we have found that although farmers are interested in the possibilities and opportunities that on-farm irrigation provides, they are slow to make the investments due to diminished cash flows and heavy debt obligations. Therefore, Mr. Speaker, I propose to make available $1.4 million to fund the installation of on-farm irrigation equipment in the areas where the off-farm infrastructure has been established. The Banana Emergency Recovery Unit Bureau, which will work in tandem with the Banana Industry Trust in executing this program, has estimated that there will be a 30% increase in production in the areas that will benefit from this infrastructure. In order to provide this project with the breathing space that it will require to succeed in the long term, and more importantly, allow the beneficiary farmers some level of initial relief, the Ministry of Agriculture, Bureau, and BIT will collaborate with WIBDECO through a memorandum of understanding to provide support to these farmers for the cost of diesel, oil, and equipment maintenance. In keeping with the dictates of the European Union market and the supermarket to which we supply our bananas, the assistance provided under this project will be targeted at those farmers who are certified as Europe GAP Fair Trade compliant, have a farm size of a minimum of 4 acres, and have maintained a minimum historical production over the past 2 years of 10 large carton equivalents per week per acre. We are confident that with this initiative, together with the recently announced support from WIBDECO, for leaf spot control and fertilizer subsidy, St. Lucia's banana industry will receive the assistance that it requires to maintain market share in the United Kingdom. I repeat, Mr. Speaker, never before has so much been done for the banana industry by way of direct financial support. These are the indisputable facts. In 2005, Mr. Speaker, Cabinet approved a generous package of incentives to the agricultural sector in an effort to spur further activity in non-traditional agriculture. It is important to note that the new agriculture incentive regime encourages the formation of farmers' associations and provides 100% of waiver of import duties on a broad range of farming equipment and inputs to those associations. Farmers who do not belong to such cooperatives or associations are entitled to a 60% waiver of duties associated with the importation of farming equipment and inputs. Mr. Speaker, while these programs have had some impact, the decline in the agricultural sector, and in particular the volume of bananas exported, have continued. The performance of banana agriculture is largely related to the harsh and uncompromising nature of the external trading environment. The non-traditional agricultural sector has been affected by weak marketing and institutional arrangements and limited access to capital. Developments on the international banana market signal the need to strengthen domestic linkages between tourism and agriculture. As the preferential trading regime that we operate within is phased out, we must become creative and explore all avenues to improve value added within the agricultural sector. The growing tourism industry presents an opportunity for participation of the local farming community in that sector through significant absorption of domestically produced crops and other agricultural products. Mr. Speaker, while the supermarkets and hotels in St. Lucia have been purchasing from our local farmers, several factors have militated against further expansion of that trade. Access to finance continues to be one of the main factors impacting on the development of the sector. Commercial banks and other financial institutions assign very high risk to agricultural activities and are very reluctant to lend to farmers. For instance, in 2005, commercial bank credit to the agricultural sector declined by 7% and represented a net 1.2% of total credit to the economy. Similarly, Mr. Speaker, commercial bank credit to agriculture declined by 3.2% in 2004, representing a 2% of total credit. As a result of rising oil prices, the cost of inputs has increased, thus impacting on the competitiveness of the domestic agricultural sector. The absence of formal marketing arrangements and weak farmers' associations have also had a dilatory effect on output of the agricultural sector. Mr. Speaker, farmers have been complaining about a very strange practice by hotels in St. Lucia. Not only farmers, Mr. Speaker, but also parliamentarians. The complaints suggest that some hotels have been utilizing a 90-day payment cycle rather than a 30-day cycle to pay farmers for their produce. This practice places further strain on the financial affairs of farmers. Our government feels that it is grossly unfair that the hotels, which in many cases have been granted generous incentive packages, should withhold payments to farmers with minimal sources of income for a full 90 days. To the credit of the St. Lucia Hotel and Tourism Association, an effort has been made in recent times to engage the farmers in discussion to arrive at a mutually satisfactory solution. Our government recognizes that it cannot intervene directly to ameliorate all and every problem. However, we are of the view that the provision of appropriate incentives to relevant institutions can ensure that private sector institutions and the market produce outcomes that will support greater integration between the tourism and agriculture sectors. Our objective is to facilitate this. Mr. Speaker, in light of this, government proposes to implement the following initiatives during financial year 2006-2007. A tax credit system to commercial banks that will encourage growth in credit to the agricultural sector. This credit system will be implemented over a three-year period. The government will exempt 75% of interest income earned on agricultural loans from payment of corporation taxes. This will be phased out to 50% in 2007. And 33% in 2008. A line of credit of EC $2 million to the newly established Chamber of Agriculture to facilitate development of the industry. The line of credit would be utilized for the following purposes. One, to establish a warehousing, sorting, packaging, and storage facility. And two, to establish a financing mechanism that will allow the entity to operate as an intermediary between farmer associations, and the hotel sector. So the policy, therefore, Mr. Speaker, is to provide this line of credit to the Chamber of Agriculture, who will then manage the relationship between the farmers and the hotels, and hopefully address some of the existing problems. Mr. Speaker, I expect that these new initiatives, coupled with the existing agriculture incentive regime, will assist in strengthening inter-sector linkages, thereby spreading the benefits of the tourism industry to farmers and rural communities. Mr. Speaker, there is one project whose status must be clarified. This is the proposed fish landing facility and jetty for Anslery. I know that the parliamentary representative, as well as the citizens of Anslery, are exceedingly anxious to have their jetty. Mr. Speaker, in the 2003 2004 budget address, I had announced that the government of St. Lucia would finance the construction of the jetty. However, the government has advised that the government of Japan was willing to construct a fish landing facility in Anchorage and would incorporate a jetty in the design. After considerable delay, a technical mission from Japan arrived in St. Lucia to assess the viability of the project and to undertake the necessary studies. A memorandum of understanding has now been agreed on the follow-up activities. The government of St. Lucia will be required to demolish the existing jetty in the course of this year. I repeat, because this is very important, the government has a responsibility under the memorandum of understanding to demolish the existing jetty. And I hope the parliamentary representative will explain this very carefully to his constituents. Hopefully, construction of the new facility will commence early next year. So after what has been a long wait, I'm optimistic that the people of Anchorage will have their jetty. Mr. Speaker, investments in the security of St. Lucia have been substantial over the past 9 years. Some may think that the country is yet to reap the benefits of this investment. But we must continue to persevere in our relentless fight against crime. We must never give up. Mr. Speaker, I am pleased to confirm that construction of the forensic science laboratory announced last year has commenced on the site which previously housed the old female prison. The facility will be constructed at a cost of $3,831,801, of which $2,735,424 is allocated this year. An amount of $688,174 has been allocated for the purchase of specialized furniture and equipment for the facility. Construction work on the facility is expected to last approximately 7 months. The commissioning of the facility is projected for December 2006. Speaker, the government has always given its commitment to do all within its powers to address the level of crime in St. Lucia, and this facility represents a critical component in moving that process forward. It is an expensive but significant step in the fight against crime. Over the past 2 years, Mr. Speaker, there has been a phenomenal increase in robberies and burglaries in private homes, commercial houses, and tourism establishments. The residents in the north of the island, unfortunately, are regular targets. Obviously, other persons throughout St. Lucia are targeted, but the problems in the north are particularly serious. Many of the victims have simply given up in frustration. Yet, the problem has to be addressed because there is no greater invasion of one's privacy and security than burglary and robbery. The loss of confidence is palpable and understandable. The fact is the detection rate for robberies and burglaries is less than 10%. That's how bad it is. All kinds of explanations have been offered for this ridiculously low detection rate. The police argue that the manual system of fingerprint identification is inefficient and ineffective. In response, government has decided to purchase this year an automated state-of-the-art fingerprinting system at a cost of EC $750,000. Mr. Speaker, government will continue its program to increase the number of police officers in the Royal St. Lucia Police Force. Currently, 65 recruits are undergoing training and are expected to graduate in July 2006. On completion of this training cycle, a further 60 recruits will enter the Police Training Academy. These officers will be assigned to the Special Services Unit to bring the overall strength of this unit to 100 officers. Mr. Speaker, these interventions, coupled with the acquisition of more police vehicles, scooters, operational communications equipment, and the technical assistance from the 7 former British police officers, of which Her Excellency spoke this morning, should indicate the seriousness with which our government views the fight against crime. You will recall, Mr. Speaker, that in the budget presentation last year, I announced that the government of St. Lucia would pursue a three-pronged approach to reforms in the water sector. The three issues that we indicated that we would pursue are as follows. One, launch an urgent investment program financed with US$7.7 million from the World Bank to relieve the water shortage problems in the north. This project will commence shortly. Two, operationalize the newly established legal framework that establishes efficiency incentives and economic rewards for higher levels of service and performance in the water sector. And three, create a public-private sector partnership for the water utility that opens the board and management control of WASCO to the private sector, thus facilitating the transition of WASCO into an efficiently managed and operated, financially self-sustainable, customer-oriented company. I'm pleased to announce, Mr. Speaker, that we are well on the way to meeting these objectives. In respect of addressing the water shortage problems in the north, a contract has been signed between the Government of St. Lucia and a construction consortium called General Earth Movers UEM Incorporated Limited earlier this year. The contract is a turnkey contract, meaning that the contractor is expected to undertake both the design and construction of the works. Design is well on the way and construction is expected to commence shortly. It is anticipated that this project will be completed in time for 2007 Cricket World Cup. The legislative framework has been completed with the passage of the new Water and Sewage Act and the establishment of the Commission. The Water Resource Management Unit will be established at the Ministry of Agriculture subsequent to the passage of the Estimates of Expenditure in this Honorable House. The only action left on the legislative agenda is the coming into force of the Act, which will be undertaken by the Honorable Minister responsible for public utilities following the regularization of some administrative matters. But, Mr. Speaker, the most important aspect of this transformation is about to unfold. The Cabinet of Ministers has agreed to the process by which there will be a public-private sector partnership in the management and operations of the water utility. This public-private sector partnership will be very similar to what obtained in Lucilec and will build on what has been a very successful experience. Mr. Speaker, we cannot continue to allow WASCO to lurch from crisis to crisis. Government cannot continue to borrow and borrow and borrow for WASCO. It is simply unsustainable. Presently, WASCO's total debt liability stands at $112.3 million. The government bears the responsibility for this debt and meets all payments on behalf of WASCO. WASCO cannot pay its debt. The debt has to be paid by the taxpayers from the consolidated fund. Cabinet has endorsed the following. One, the establishment of the public-private sector partnership company to manage the affairs of the water sector. Two, 20% of the ownership of the public-private partnership company will be held by the government of St. Lucia. WASCO will remain as the vehicle through which the government of St. Lucia will own equity in the public-private partnership. The partnership company will also be entitled to the right of use of the Roseau Dam through an evergreen service agreement. In other words, the ownership of the Roseau Dam will remain with the government of St. Lucia. So too will all catchment areas and other natural assets be owned by the government and people of St. Lucia. Four, the ministers responsible for public utilities and agriculture will, under the provisions of the Water and Sewage Act, issue licenses to the partnership company for providing the water service as well as an abstraction license. Five, the operator will be a member of the investment consortium, which in turn will provide solid performance guarantees that are either directly or indirectly provided by the operator. And sixthly, The board of the partnership company will comprise 5 executive members. The company will also be expected to manage procurement in the most open and transparent manner. Cabinet has agreed to the engagement of a specialized public relations firm to carry out a public sensitization program to explain the proposed changes to consumers. Importantly also, the government wants to ensure that the employees of WASCO are engaged in dialogue so that their concerns are fully addressed and resolved. Mr. Speaker, I know that some members of the public may be skeptical about this public-private sector relationship, and in particular, there will be some concerns regarding its impact on poor and marginalized groups. It is the intention of government to ensure that a mechanism is put in place to provide for persons who are in need of special assistance. To meet this objective, government has already commenced discussions with the World Bank Group for the provision of a facility that would allow for the provision of grants to the poor and marginalized groups to access connections to the water supply. I know too that there are fears that the new entity will increase water rates. 2 points must be made. Firstly, government has made it absolutely clear that there can be no increases in tariffs until and unless there is significant improvement in the delivery of water. Indeed, it is specifically agreed that there will be no increases for the next 3 years. Secondly, tariffs will be set by a regulatory authority. The new company will not be allowed to increase its tariffs at its will or on its own choosing. Mr. Speaker, it is the government's view that the process on which we are embarking will bring some stability to the supply and provision of safe and wholesome water to the majority of our citizens in the entire country. As we continue on this road to the completion of this process, we must implore our citizens to be patient and work along with the government and other private and public sector partners to ensure the attainment of the goal of water for all. Mr. Speaker, I now turn to a matter that always seems to provoke strong, impassioned, and sometimes uninformed debate, and that is our taxes. It is time that we seriously begin to examine our taxes. Mr. Speaker, since coming into office, this government has made adjustments to the tax system that have creatively spread the tax burden. Persons at the lower end of the earnings bracket have been relieved of the burden of paying income tax. Today, if you earn $16,000 and less, you don't pay income tax. This government introduced this policy. Some pensioners now enjoy the benefit of not paying property taxes, and workers in the hospitality industry also enjoy, in addition to low income tax, tax-free earnings on their tips and gratuities. And so it goes on. Mr. Speaker, owners of ground transportation in the tourism sector also benefit from waivers in import duties and consumption taxes on vehicles imported for use in the sector. But while we have been making all of these adjustments, it is becoming increasingly clear that there is a growing need for us to re-examine the tax regime. Mr. Speaker, I want to make it clear that a re-examination does not necessarily translate into an increase in the tax burden. As a matter of fact, this re-examination may in fact reveal ways of further spreading the tax burden so as to make the regime more equitable. It is important to note that the current tax regime is not unique to St. Lucia, but was in fact developed internationally and through a process of adaptation implemented in St. Lucia. If one examines the history of taxation in the English-speaking Caribbean, there are common threads that can be observed in the evolution of taxation systems. So, Mr. Speaker, a reassessment of our taxation system in these changing times ought not to set the alarm bells ringing. Instead, it should be in natural expectation. Permit me to highlight some of the changes, especially in the context of an erosion of tax revenues due to trade liberalization, which have occurred in recent times in the Caribbean region. Indeed, Mr. Speaker, I wish to warn this Honorable House and the population at large that the regime of consumption tax that is currently in existence is incompatible with WTO requirements and will therefore have to give way. Don't blame this government because the reservations were not made when St. Lucia signed the WTO agreement many years ago. And we will have no choice. What are these changes in the other island? Trinidad and Tobago. Jamaica and Barbados have all remodeled their consumption tax regime and introduced a value-added tax-based system. In fact, as recently as this year, Trinidad and Tobago revamped its income tax regime by increasing personal allowances from $25,000 to $60,000 and removing some individual allowances like the home mortgage interest deduction, child allowance, and the allowance for shares purchased in a registered credit union. If this inspires a feeling of deja vu, it is because these are similar to the recommendations proposed a few years ago by the IMF for St. Lucia. I'm sure many will remember that acrimonious debate then. But there you have it, Trinidad and Tobago has gone that route. But I guess you can see that they can go that route with their oil revenues. Trinidad and Tobago have also replaced the tiered system of tax rates with a flat rate of 25% across the board. In our case here, we have four bands of taxation. Two, the Commonwealth of Dominica introduced VAT on March 1, 2006 with minimal reported disruptions in business activity. Three, the governments of Antigua and Barbuda, Grenada, St. Vincent and the Grenadines have announced their intention to introduce a VAT-based system. Mr. Speaker, you may recall that we commissioned a group of citizens to review the report produced by the Tax Commission established by the Monetary Council of the Eastern Caribbean Central Bank. I am pleased to announce that the review has been completed and that the government will soon be in a position to release the report for public scrutiny. In addition, Mr. Speaker, the various trading negotiating arenas in which we now participate will force us to reassess our tax regimes, particularly those that relate to our border taxes, such as import duty, and I have already warned you, excise and consumption taxes. Once we have reviewed these regimes, we will be compelled to reevaluate our internal taxes so as to make any necessary adjustments. Mr. Speaker, I wish to reiterate that any changes must be built on the philosophy of fairness and equity. I have cataloged these recent events to demonstrate there is going to be a need for St. Lucia to undertake its own review of the tax regime currently in force in the country. It is an inescapable fact that whichever party forms the government after the next general elections will have to face the issue of tax reform squarely. Whichever party will have to face that issue very, very square. So, this is the time to place the option before the electorate. Now that the principal budgetary policies have been outlined, I will proceed to explain how the budget will be financed. In formulating a budget, Mr. Speaker, we have the difficult task of striking the correct balance between taxes, expenditures, and debt. Our task is to ensure that current and future generations are treated fairly. At a minimum, current generations should be required to pay tax for the goods and services that they consume. We also believe that the current generation should contribute to investment, as they are also beneficiaries of the future growth that is generated by that investment. We must also ensure that we do not unduly burden the future generation by increasing debt to unsustainable levels. We have, Mr. Speaker, carefully evaluated the policy options and the policy trade-offs, and believe that we have come up with an optimal balance between policies that will contribute to sustaining growth while at the same time ensuring that our debt remains sustainable. I shall now present the budget estimates for the 2006-2007 fiscal year. The total planned level of expenditure amounts to $1,121.5 million, representing an increase of 17.3% over the planned budgetary outlay in the 2005-2006 fiscal year. In effect, this is a $1.1 billion budget. And this is the first time that Sibusha has struck or reached the baseline of a $1.1 billion budget. As I've said before, Mr. Speaker, and you heard the figures earlier on, this is now a billion-dollar economy with savings in the banking system of several billion dollars. I think we know the figure, I think, at 1.2.8 billion. The details are as follows. The planned level of recurring expenditure exclusive of amortization is $611.6 million, representing 54.5% of total planned expenditure, and is 9.8% higher than the previous year. Two, debt amortization is forecast at $88.5 million and accounts for 7.9% of total planned expenditure. 7.9%. And I hope the member for Denry North heard this. The planned level of capital expenditure is forecast to increase by 25.5% to $421.4 million and accounts for 37.6% of the total budget. This increase largely reflects the continuation of ongoing capital projects and the rebudgeting of EU grant finance projects, as funding was not received in the last fiscal year for reasons familiar to honorable members. The sources of financing for the 2006-2007 budget are as follows. Recurrent revenue of $621.6 million. Capital revenue of $9.2 million. Excess revenue and rebudgeting of funds from fiscal year 2005-2006 to $16 million. Grant funding of $76.5 million. Of which $61.4 million is from the European Union. Previously approved loan funding of $153.8 million. Previously approved bond funding of $88.4 million. Members are asked to note that Parliament approved by resolution dated 12 September 2005 an amount of $188.4 million to be raised by the issue of savings bonds to assist in the financing of capital and other expenditure and debt refinancing. However, we decided to raise only $100 million. The unutilized bond funding of $88.4 million is to be applied to refinance existing debt and therefore will not add to our debt stock. New loan funding of $32.4 million in substitution for previous bond financing, for which I shall seek the approval of this Honorable House later. New bond funding of $123.6 million. In effect, Mr. Speaker, I shall be seeking the approval of this Honorable House for $156 million for new funding. This amount, Honorable Members, will be pleased to know is $32.4 million lower than the amount that I sought approval for last year, which was $188.4 million. This confirms the downward trend of borrowing. Allow me, Mr. Speaker, to comment on our forecast for the 2006-2007 fiscal year. This government, Mr. Speaker, has always erred on the side of caution in making projections of revenue and expenditure. We tend to be highly conservative in our revenue estimates, and as a result, tend to underestimate. Conversely, our precautionary approach leads us to overestimate recurrent expenditure. In many other countries, the practice is the reverse. And as a result, those countries experience fiscal problems. Given that St. Lucia is a highly vulnerable economy susceptible to shocks, our approach to forecasting is conservative and judicious. In order to see the benefits of that practice, I shall review last year's fiscal performance against the planned budget. Mr. Speaker, last year I projected recurrent revenue at $546.2 million. I indicated that we had to be cautious because of the worrying trend of increasing oil prices. While oil prices did increase, Mr. Speaker, we had to make some adjustments. I am now pleased to report that revenue intake was $73 million, or 13.4% higher than the actual forecast. This additional revenue has enabled us to meet our commitments to public servants in respect of new salaries and back pay. More crucially, we have been able to reduce our borrowing requirements. Mr. Speaker, I wish to emphasize that our sound fiscal management enabled us to pay the back pay to public servants without having to resort to borrowing from the banks or, for that matter, the central bank, as has happened in the past. In addition, Mr. Speaker, we have planned to raise bonds of $189.6 million to finance the capital program last year, of which $56 million was earmarked for the Cricket World Cup project. Given that we received more favorable rates from a bank than what we would have obtained from the regional government securities market, RGSM, we decided to take a loan for Cricket World Cup. This reduced our bond requirement to $133.6 million. However, given our excellent revenue performance, Mr. Speaker, we only had to raise bonds of $100 million. Mr. Speaker, this is proof that the financial stewardship of this country is in safe hands. This year, Mr. Speaker, while we are projecting real GDP growth of 6.6%, we are again going to err on the side of caution and project revenue collections at only $621.6 million, a mere $2.4 million above last year's actual collections. If our real GDP growth materializes, as we have every reason to believe it will, revenue collections may actually climb to $680 million. The results, Mr. Speaker, of an economy in its expansion phase. But, Mr. Speaker, we are cautious. We are again haunted by the specter of rising oil prices, which hit a peak of US$75 per barrel only last week. We have also been told to expect another active hurricane season, so we need to be on guard. This budget, Mr. Speaker, is framed to enhance our social infrastructure and to strengthen programs in health, education, social protection, security, and justice. These are programs that are ultimately important for improving the welfare of our society, and particularly of the more vulnerable groups. This budget is therefore a budget with the future in mind. It provides for the future opportunities of the youth, the future care of the elderly, the provision of health services that our citizens will require for the foreseeable future, and for the long-term growth and development of St. Lucia's economy. I now turn to the distribution of the budget among agencies. Comprehensive details of expenditure by agencies, programs, and activities are contained in the draft 2006-2007 estimates, copies of which have been circulated to honorable members. The proposed allocation to the economic service agencies is $682 million, 24.7% higher than the amount allocated last year, and 60.8% of the total budget. The amount allocated to recurrent expenditure is $387.7 million, of which $180.5 million is for debt servicing and $40.9 million is for the payment of pensions to retired public servants. And I want honorable members to note that figure, $40.9 million, and this figure is increasing yearly. I have also increased the capital allocation to these agencies significantly by 36.2% to $294.4 million. This increase reflects largely the amounts required to complete ongoing projects. Mr. Speaker, you recall that is our intention to raise all the funds for Cricket World Cup, for the Cricket World Cup project in the last fiscal year, given that I predicted that interest rates were likely to increase. I am pleased to say that this was the right decision, as interest rates have increased and are expected to continue to increase. The funding for this project has been raised, and we are in effect rebudgeting the balance of the loan funds, which amounted to 42.8 million, to complete the upgrading of the Bolsiju Cricket Ground and provide for the operating expenditures for the hosting of the matches. As indicated in my last budget presentation, government has launched a major water infrastructure improvement program, which is aimed at alleviating the water shortage problem in the north of the island. Earlier, I reiterated this initiative. Honourable members, I'm sure would agree that this improvement program is critically needed as the development in the north continues apace. I would like, for the benefit of honourable members, to restate the components of this program. One, upgrading the Rosa Dam pumping station. Two, improving the raw water transmission between Vana and Sarak. Three, upgrading the Sibbles water treatment plant. And four, upgrading the Mon Bokas distribution pipeline. As I indicated, the contractor for the project is in the process of mobilizing for commencement. This project, which is financed by the World Bank, is expected to be completed in 1 year and will bring relief to residents living in the north of the island. An allocation of $26.4 million has been made for this project. Mr. Speaker, this government has made record levels of investment in road infrastructure over the past 5 years. This has been necessary because of the aging road infrastructure and the rapid deterioration in the road network. This year we will continue with our investment program. The Ministry of Communications, Works, Transport and Public Utilities is a recipient of $106.9 million, $46.1 million or 75.8% higher than the allocation received last year. An allocation of $28 million is made to the East Coast Road Project. It is expected that phase two of the project, which covers Castries to Prale, will be completed. The rehabilitation will also commence on some of the critical sections of the road between Prale and Beaufort. Honourable members would also note that work has commenced on phase one of the Castries to Groslay Highway. This project, which covers a section of the highway between Castries and Shop, will cause some discomfort to motorists. Once again, I plead for your patience and understanding as we seek to improve and widen this road network. On completion, traffic congestion is expected to be relieved significantly. An allocation of $28.1 million has been earmarked for this project. The Urban Renewal Program, which is explained earlier in my presentation, will receive an allocation of $9.6 million. It is expected that the Tertiary Roads Program, which entailed the rehabilitation of 108 kilometers of road, will be completed this year, and a provision of just under $23 million is made for this project. Additionally, Mr. Speaker, I have allocated $5.3 million towards community infrastructure. After spending significant sums of money to rehabilitate our roads, it is absolutely important that we develop a maintenance plan to prevent the recurrence of this situation in the near future. In addition, Mr. Speaker, it is important that we reduce the damage caused by heavy goods vehicles. As a result, we have agreed to implement a motor vehicle weight control system. An allocation of $1.5 million is earmarked for this initiative. The expansion of the St. Lucia economy has been driven in large part by the tourism sector. This sector is now the engine of growth of the economy, and it is crucial that government provides the requisite support. I propose, therefore, to increase the overall allocation to this sector to $29.6 million. Of this amount, $25.8 million will be allocated to tourism marketing, and I will take direct interest in the expenditure of this money. Sadly, Mr. Speaker, last year we could not implement the Agriculture Diversification Program because the anticipated receipt of Special Framework of Assistance, SFA funds, from the EU did not materialize. We are assured that most of the bureaucratic hurdles have been resolved and are hopeful that funding will become available early in the fiscal year. Reflecting the importance that our government has attached to agricultural diversification, we have programmed $9.2 million for this program. Last year, I announced a comprehensive package of incentives for the agricultural sector. I wish to complement our incentives program with a capacity building program for which a sum of $2 million is allocated. Notwithstanding the low level of production, for reasons outlined earlier, government remains committed to supporting the restructuring of the banana industry to enhance productivity and thereby enable it to survive post-2006 and in a tariff-only regime environment. This year, I have allocated $4.7 million to the sector, of which $1.4 million is to continue the ongoing irrigation and drainage project implemented by the BIT, and $3.3 million is for the Banana Emergency Recovery Unit Bureau. With the rising price of construction material, it is important for government to continue to provide some measure of support to low-income households. The low-income housing grant facility, a very popular program, Mr. Speaker, had to be suspended last year because of the non-availability of EU resources. However, as I indicated earlier, we are now advised that the funding will be available this year, and we have accordingly allocated a sum of $2 million to this facility. Honourable members will recall that this facility has two components. One, for low-income persons who own their lots, the government will provide a grant support of 10% of a loan to construct a home up to the maximum of $10,000. So if the person has a lot, we will give you grant support of 10% of the loan up to a maximum of $10,000. For those persons who do not own a lot, the government will provide grant support of 20% of the loan up to a maximum of $20,000. So if you do not own the land and you're looking to purchase the land, as you do your negotiations, and what we will do is make available a grant support of 20% of the loan to you to enable you to acquire the land and ultimately to get the money you need to construct your home. Amounts of $5.7 million and $2.1 million are allocated to the ongoing programs of shelter development and PROS respectively. With the Cat 3 and ancillary flood mitigation project coming to an end, the major ongoing disaster mitigation project that will continue this year is phase two of the World Bank funded St. Lucia Emergency Recovery and Disaster Management Project. A sum of $10.3 million is allocated to complete the coastal protection works for the Denry Village to rehabilitate bridges and implement mitigation works. Mr. Speaker, it is no secret that this government places strong emphasis on the social services because improving the welfare of our people is on the top of our agenda. This year, I have increased the overall allocation to the social service agencies by almost $30 million, or 10.8%, to $306.3 million. Of this amount, $204.7 million is for recurrent expenditure, and $101.6 million is for capital expenditure. The world economy is increasingly being driven, Mr. Speaker, by knowledge-based industries. A skilled workforce is a key requirement for making the successful transition from a low-wage economy to a high-wage economy. According to the World Bank report, A Time to Choose, Caribbean Development in the 20th Century, the private returns to education for St. Lucia are as follows. 6% for secondary education, 34% for post-secondary education, and 22% for tertiary education. This study, Mr. Speaker, gives real meaning to the statement that our Nobel laureate Sir Arthur Lewis made so long ago, quote, the cure for poverty is not money, but education. This is why, Mr. Speaker, this government has placed increasing emphasis on the establishment of a sound education and training system. I have allocated a sum of $168.2 million to the Ministry of Education. As a percentage of GDP, this represents almost 7%. Mr. Speaker, it is instructive to note that in the same World Bank study to which I referred earlier, only Barbados in the Caribbean spends more on education as a percentage of GDP than Seychelles. I am proud, as I am sure are all honorable members and indeed all Seychellians, of achieving a major milestone in our national development with the implementation of universal secondary education. A capital allocation of $26.8 million or 63.3% of the ministry's budget is made to the project, namely the Education Development Project, which supports the implementation of universal secondary education. Mr. Speaker, I have allocated $6.2 million for the rehabilitation of schools, of which $5.1 million is earmarked for the refurbishment of schools falling within the economic restructuring program financed by CDB. Additionally, $1.1 million has been allocated for major repairs to the school plant. Our capital program for human resource development was unfortunately also affected by the non-receipt of EU funds. I have, as you heard already, allocated a sum of $3.2 million this year, of which $2 million is allocated directly to the NSDC, and $1.2 million is for a human resource program that is EU funded. These programs were explained earlier, so there is no need for further clarification. Mr. Speaker, I have already highlighted major interventions in the area of sports development. Suffice it to note here that the overall capital allocation increases by $1.4 million over last year's allocation. This government, Mr. Speaker, is undertaking the most radical transformation in our health sector. The transformation is based on the philosophy that health care should be available to all, irrespective of income level. And the day will come, Mr. Speaker, when ordinary solutions will not have to pay to enter a hospital, Mr. Speaker. And I hope that I too will see that day, Mr. Speaker, soon. This transformation, as I indicated, is based on the philosophy that healthcare should be available to all irrespective of income level. In keeping with our commitment to transform the health sector, I have made available an allocation of $110.5 million, of which $64.3 million is for recurrent expenditure and $46.2 million is for capital expenditure. As honorable members heard earlier, provisions have been made in the recurrent budget for the free medical drugs program for persons who suffer from diabetes and diabetes with hypertension. The capital budget of the Ministry of Health is primarily for providing the new infrastructure required to improve the delivery of our healthcare and welfare services. I wish to highlight the following allocations for the benefit of honorable members. One, $17.3 million for the new National Hospital. Two, $2.8 million for the preliminary work for the new mental health facility. Three, $716,779 for the completion of refurbishment work at the Soufriere Hospital. Four, $5.9 million for repairs to health centers. Five, $8.8 million for HIV/AIDS prevention and control. And six, $500,000 for a home repair program for the elderly. The emergency medical services and port health services will both be upgraded for the 2007 Cricket World Cup, and this enhancement will provide yet another legacy from the hosting of this event. In addition to comprehensive training of emergency medical personnel and a marked upscale of the vector control program, new ambulances will be procured. Funding for these improvements totaling $3.1 million will be derived from the budget for Cricket World Cup and from the capital reserve. The last project which I wish to highlight, Mr. Speaker, of which I spoke earlier, is a new home for the elderly, which is estimated to cost $13.1 million. An allocation of $8.6 million is made in this year's estimates for commencement of construction. As I said, this was outlined earlier. Mr. Speaker, our social program would be incomplete if we did not mention the range of poverty alleviation programs that this government has implemented and continues to implement. In this regard, Mr. Speaker, the allocation given to the Ministry of Social Transformation, Culture and Local Government is $27.6 million, of which $14.6 million is for recurrent expenditure and $30 million is for capital expenditure. I wish to highlight the following projects for the benefit of honorable members. An allocation of $7.2 million is made for the fifth program of the Basic Needs Trust Fund. I understand this program has been affected by slow disbursement, and I wish to implore the Ministry to do all in its power to speed up the implementation rate. Two, an allocation of $1.8 million for the Poverty Reduction Fund, an allocation of $2 million for an integrated social recovery program to be funded by the EU. An allocation of $462,155 is given to cultural development, of which $200,000 is provided for upgrading performing venues, $100,000 for the National Arts Festival, and $162,155 is for the training of artists and technicians. These amounts are in addition to the traditional allocations for Carnival, Asu Square, and Emancipation Day observance. Earlier in my presentation, I announced a series of initiatives that the government will be undertaking this year to improve security. I will therefore focus on other areas of Justice and Security Agency's budget. Overall, the Justice and Security Agencies will receive an increase of 14.3% in allocation this year. The total allocation to these agencies is $84.5 million. The major focus for this year for the Ministry of Justice is to complete ongoing projects. These include, one, constructing the building to house the forensic unit, which is estimated, as you heard earlier, to cost $3.8 million and for which an allocation of $2.7 million is made. A budgetary provision of $688,174 is made for the procurement of forensic equipment. Rehabilitating the High Court building, for which an allocation of $340,155 is made. Establishment of the Night Court, staffed by two additional magistrates to determine traffic cases. I also wish to announce that the government will invest significantly in security for Cricket World Cup. As I indicated in my presentation last year, we cannot afford to compromise on security for the biggest international event that St. Lucia would have ever hosted. An amount of $5 million is to be funded from the capital reserve to meet the security needs for Cricket World Cup, much of which will carry over as a legacy impact of the event. The allocation to the General Service Agencies, which include the Office of the Prime Minister and the Ministry of Labour Relations, Public Service and Cooperatives, is $42.4 million. The key highlights are, one, a sum of $12 million is provided to the Office of Private Sector Relations to support the private sector. This is from different EU sources. A sum of $1 million is for the establishment of e-government. A sum of $1.4 million is for the Constitutional Reform Commission, and $955,000 for the renovation of the Graham Luizzi Administrative Building. The Office of the Governor General and the agencies of Parliament, namely the Legislature Service Commission and the Electoral and Audit Departments, shall receive a total allocation of $6.2 million. In keeping with this government's effort at strengthening democracy, this year we will begin to see decentralizing registration services. Mr. Speaker, the only revenue adjustment that I wish to propose this fiscal year is an increase in departure taxes for visitors, underline visitors. Effective July 1, 2006, departure taxes for non-nationals will increase from US $20 to US $25. We need, Mr. Speaker, to recover the amounts that we are investing for Cricket World Cup. And this adjustment allows us to augment the revenues that we expect to earn from other Cricket World Cup related activities. Mr. Speaker, the increase in departure taxes does not affect our national, so for St. Lucians this remains a tax-free budget. Mr. Speaker, as I conclude, I am reminded of the former Indian Prime Minister Nehru, who on the verge of India's independence asked his nation whether it was brave enough and wise enough to grasp the opportunities and accept the challenges of the future. India accepted that challenge And we all know how well it is performing today. This budget issues a similar challenge to this nation. It is a budget that funds important priorities without imposing new taxes. Like last year, the reports of our performance demonstrate the increased efficiency of our revenue agencies and highlight the results of our prudent economic decisions. This budget presents expanded opportunities for the greater triumphs and achievements that await us. Mr. Speaker, any country is only as good as its citizens. Their work ethic and their values will be reflected in the country's character. These are the crucial factors that will determine whether this country moves forward on a progressive path or regressive. We will therefore need disciplined action by all citizens. We are not a poor nation as it is sometimes perceived. In fact, we have many riches endowed in the enterprise of our people, the creative energies of our youth, and in the continuing success of our many national and community endeavors. It is often said that the greatest asset of any nation is the spirit of its people. It is also true that the greatest threat to the security of any nation is the demolition of its spirit. We must never permit our caring spirit to die. Yes, there will be pulls on the seams in our social fabric, but we must never allow that fabric to be ripped apart. There will be threats to the health of our economy, but we must continue to nurture it and help build its immunity and its resilience. Mr. Speaker, we have the opportunity today to do more than ever before in our history to make life better in seclusion. We can ensure that there is universal secondary education for all of our young people. We can provide access to universal health care for all our citizens. We can create the mechanism and infrastructure to facilitate the provision of a better supply of quality water for every resident. We can seek to maintain a more sensitive and symbiotic relationship with our natural and cultural environment. We can restore our respect for law and order and for each other. We can make our communities more livable and more caring. And we can ensure the rights of every St. Lucian to full and equal economic and social opportunity. Let us therefore resolve to perform our duties diligently, resolutely and patriotically, so that future generations will proclaim, "This was St. Lucia's finest hour." I am honored, Mr. Speaker, to move the second reading of the Appropriation Bill 2006-2007. Thank you.